right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show on the road. We've made it all the way to San Jose, California for the Netroots Nation Conference. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking to a whole bunch of people we met during our time at Netroots. Pat, what did you think of the Netroots Nation Conference?
Well, I was kind of, it was extremely impressive. There was a lot of stuff I didn't expect to see. At the daily cost coffee area was kind of interesting. I mean, really, a lot of players that are on the radical edge of media, of the new media, which is the internet, were there. And then an awful lot of the old blue dogs, too. It was like a big spectrum. The spectrum that used to be the whole political spectrum, now it's just the left side.
Yeah, it was interesting. I ran into a bunch of people we've had on the program over the year, a bunch of people who listen. A couple of our listeners were there. It was really a nice event.
Yeah, I was glad that I got to go. I was especially happy to see the organizations that were there because of the generosity of so many of the labor unions that supported the event. You know, organizations that are fighting for equality in the workplace, regardless of your workplace. Equality gender-wise, equality for personal choice. Equality for all kinds of things, and then, of course, an awful lot of women's rights advocacy groups were there as well. And I don't think if those big players weren't paying the bill, that the small players would have been at the table.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So tonight on the program, we're going to be talking to a number of people we met, some folks we're going to have again in the future. I really enjoyed my time there, and I really enjoyed the just meeting new people.
Did you see the giant Monopoly board?
I did.
It was about the size of the conference room second floor lobby, and my favorite part was the waterworks, which featured the picture of John Boehner. What a blubbering baby he is.
But my daughter and I, you know, since I didn't let her take the standardized test, I opted her out of the PSSA tests in Pennsylvania. We did get to take a standardized test while we were there, and we both passed. But you know,
did she cheat for you?
No, she didn't cheat for me.
Oh, okay, just asking.
But we both passed, and we would have gotten all four answers right of the four questions, but we got number four wrong.
What was it?
Because we didn't get the right answer.
What?
There were two right answers, but we didn't choose the right answer.
The right but enough one?
Wasn't right enough. But tonight on the program, we're going to talk to the folks at Netroots Nation. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show on the road. The People's Tour for America. Right back.
What do you
give a guy who has everything?
Labor history, of course.
And where can you get a great dose of labor history?
Right here, weeknights from 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show.
From New York City factories to West Virginia coal mines to Oregon loading docks to Toledo glass factories, you'll hear all the stories right here, right up until the new year.
And then we'll be back with all new shows here on The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
January of 1964 was a time to remember for many Americans. The Beatles released their first album. New York announced plans to build a World Trade Center. The Surgeon General announced smoking kills, and President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty during his first State of the Union address. January 1964 was also a momentous year for the American truck drivers. The nation's truckers saw the first nationwide labor contract. The National Master Freight Agreement, covering some 450,000 truck drivers employed by 16,000 companies across the country, set a nationwide minimum wage of $3.33 per hour, or $23.63 in 2008, as well as providing health care and retirement benefits for all its members. The 1964 National Master Freight Agreement set a nationwide standard for working conditions, giving drivers a voice on the job and the power to stand up to abusive treatment, and eventually the ability to refuse to drive equipment the driver deemed unsafe. Led by labor visionary James R. Hoffa, this victory was the crowning achievement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters as one of America's most influential unions. This landmark agreement created a framework for all national contracts to follow. Jimmy Hoffa, the man who famously quipped, "I may have many faults, being wrong is not one of them," was certainly right about the benefits, power, and influence of such a national agreement for workers, both union and non-union. Wages and benefits earned by truck drivers brought millions of hardworking men and women solidly into the middle class by rewarding hard work with a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. For generations, the National Master Freight Agreement served as the industry standard for all truck drivers, raising wages, improving benefits, and providing a safer workplace for drivers and the motoring public. Unfortunately, since the 1980 passage of trucking deregulation, the industry has resorted to cutthroat competition based on who was willing to work for less. In this environment, the National Master Freight Agreement has lost some of its power in lifting truck drivers out of low wage, no benefit, and hazardous conditions. Currently, many non-union truck drivers are earning at or near poverty wages while pushing legal limits. For many truckers, their pay is solely determined by the number of miles they drive. Breakdowns, time spent waiting to be loaded and unloaded, and other delays are shouldered by the driver, in most cases without compensation. 1964 and the years that followed has shown what can be accomplished by workers standing together. Perhaps the future will see resurgence in worker solidarity and the reemergence of a fair day's work, a fair day's pay. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. On the road here in San Jose, California, the People's Tour for America. You can find out where we've been, where we're going, who we're going to talk to next, right there at PeoplesTourForAmerica.com. Here at the Netroots Nation Conference, I got these really nifty Three Stooge type hammers for the kids. That'll be fun watching them beat each other with these. The good people at SmartCitiesPrevail.org was handing them out. And I got to tell you, now, as we look at the budget in Pennsylvania, the talk about ending prevailing wage, and, you know, well, ending reasonable wages, maybe going back to slave wages. What the hell? Desperation class is what it is. I saw this group and I go, you know, we got to talk about this, because this assault not just happening in Pennsylvania, not happening just in California, but all across the nation. I've got Dale Howard, spokesperson for SmartCitiesPrevail.org, sitting here with me. Dale, thanks for taking time for us.
It's good to be here.
You know, when I saw your sign, I'm going, someone to stand up for prevailing wage? Tell me it's not true.
It is true. We have been doing that for several years now, going around California trying to educate people on the issue of prevailing wage, why it's important, and how it can help communities.
So what I hear from the right wing, and I hope you can correct the right wing, because what they keep saying is, Rick, you know, times are tough. Communities are broke. The state's broke. We don't have any money. There's no money out there. And there's this thing, this evil tool, this prevailing wage, which is stealing from me.
Right. Well, I will give you an example that's right near where we are right now. There were two libraries that were built in the last couple of years here, one in Gilroy, California, one in Palo Alto. One used prevailing wage, one didn't. In Palo Alto, they chose to go without prevailing wage, and they ended up spending $97 more per square foot than in Gilroy, where they did use prevailing wage.
Okay, well, big numbers, because we love huge numbers. Since the right wing loves to throw out huge numbers, what kind of money are you talking about, $97 a square foot? Are we talking hundreds of thousands, millions? Where are we with this?
Millions.
Millions.
Yes.
So, you know, I keep hearing people saying, and I'm hoping this you'll correct this. I have friends who say, well, we could save 30%. You've said that they've already spent millions over. Where's that 30% savings?
Well, there's not 30% savings. And, you know, what you'll find out is they make this claim that there's going to be 30% savings. If you eliminate prevailing wage, you can save 30% when you build your library or your other project.
Didn't work
project.
So well.
Didn't work there. And the fact of the matter is, on average, labor accounts for about 22% of a project cost in the size of the projects that we're talking
okay,
about here.
Let me think this through. 22% of the cost of the total construction. If I'm going to save 33% or 30%, mathematically, third grade math, that's not possible.
It's not possible. And, you know, my suggestion tends to be, you know, I guess they're going to have it built with magic beans, because to save that much on labor, you would have to eliminate every employee that works on the project. And then somehow, you know, the bricks will lay themselves and the paint will magically go on the wall, because there wouldn't be any money left to pay anyone if you eliminated 30%.
Well, if you really took it to the next level, which I think the business community or some in the business community would like to see it, you look at Alabama, you look at some places in Mississippi where they've used prison labor. We were in Grundy County, Tennessee, where they actually used prison labor to do all the work there and paid the contractors. So maybe the view down the road to be business friendly is we'll use prison labor and the state will pay the contractor for keeping them, thus getting the 30%.
Yeah, that's a strange proposition, and I hope that we're never going there in California, at least. I think we're safe from that for the moment.
But, you know, in Pennsylvania, where we're from, all of this stuff is right there as well. We hear the same message. We're going to save 30%. We're going to get all of this wonderful stuff. Yet in the places that have eliminated prevailing wage, and there have been a number of places around the country that have, what we've seen is we've seen costs go up. We've seen quality go through the floor. Why would anybody rationally go, this is a good idea?
I honestly don't know how you could see that it's a bad idea. If people go to our website at smartcitiesprevail.org, there are a lot of studies that have been done on there that show all the different ways why prevailing wage is beneficial and why there's virtually no benefit to going in the opposite direction.
What's the benefit to prevailing wage?
I'll give you a big benefit, especially when you're dealing on the local level and the state level. More employees that work in prevailing wage projects live in the local area. So it's a boon to local areas. Whether you're talking about a state or whether you're talking about a municipality, the workers tend to be more local, and they spend a dollar there, generates $1.50 in the local economy. So every dollar that you put into a prevailing wage project in the area where that work is done, it generates $1.50 in economic activity.
So you have that reverberation effect, whereas if you had a transient workforce, they take that money with them.
Right. I mean, you can end up in transient workforces, you know, especially when you're a state that's neighboring another state, and, you know, you lower the standard, prevailing wage is eliminated, and then, you know, in the case of California, maybe a firm could come in from Arizona or Utah and do the work. So then that money is being shipped back out to employees who don't live in the local community. You know, it's great to create jobs with public works, but it's even better if you can create jobs in your local community so that the tax dollars stay local.
Walk me through this bidding process, because, you know, I've had a lot of people say, well, if you didn't have the prevailing wage, employers could get employees at market wage, which, understand, the prevailing wage is the market wage. It's the most prevalent in Pennsylvania anyway. I don't know how it operates here in California, but in Pennsylvania, it's the wage most often paid. It's not
right.
An average. It's the wage.
It's
most
the modal
often.
Wage.
Exactly. So, you know, the argument is if they could pay less, the costs would come down, and do taxpayers see any of that benefit? Because, you know, let's say you're cheating these workers and you're stealing these wages and these benefits, and let's say that's a good thing. If you, just for argument's sake, do the taxpayers benefit in any way?
It doesn't seem that the taxpayers do benefit in any way that you can see, because there are many facets to this, and what ends up happening is when you spend the money and you pay people well and they have benefits, then that's other money that taxpayers don't have to spend. So what you do notice is that fewer people need public assistance, and you just go down the line. Right. So other people have businesses that prosper as a result of people having more money in their pocket. So in the grand scheme of things, there isn't a benefit. The only benefit is to the employer who's paying the lower wage gets to keep more of the money.
And that's the key, right?
Yes.
Because, I've seen study after study that showed in states that don't have the prevailing wage, that they've done away with it, the bidding hasn't gone down. In fact, in Pennsylvania, when for a very short period of time they did away with it, what they found out is the bids actually went up, because you had a whole bunch of people now going, hey, profit time.
Right.
You actually had to go back and rebid using the prevailing wage, which brought the costs down. And you laugh.
No,
but it's what happened.
We've been there. Yes.
I'm trying to tell people, look, when they're trying to, that too good to be true thing?
Mm-hmm.
If it sounds too good to be true, it is.
Right.
And right here we are.
That's exactly right.
So walk me through this as well, because, as someone who believes in having a safe workplace.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any studies that you know of, any factual data where workplaces are safer under the prevailing wage, where workers have a safe work environment because you have a common standard of conditions?
Yes, there is. And there are studies on our website that would go to support those things. And, specifically, I would just say that part of the safety is because there are more controls on the situation. But the other thing that figures into that is the workers tend to be better trained, better skilled, more experienced, oftentimes have gone through an apprenticeship program to really learn what they're doing, do it well, and do it safely.
Now, are these union workers, non-union workers?
They can be both. Prevailing wage can be union, and sometimes it's not.
So because we hear it all the time in Pennsylvania, that, that's the union wage. That's the union wage. Is it the union wage?
It can be. But, it's not exclusively union.
Well, it's the wage that's most frequently paid.
Right.
And, in Pennsylvania, what we have is we have certain contractors who, and maybe it's just they're ashamed to say how little they're paying people, but they don't report.
Right.
And what you have is the argument that it's the union wages. They're the people who are proud that, we pay our people a decent living wage that have money to go and spend in the local community.
Right. Right. And, that's the most important part of it. You have to pay people enough that they can live. You have to pay enough that they can support their family and enjoy the community.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Dale Howard, spokesperson for SmartCitiesPrevail.org. We'll put a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Dale, in going here to California, you told me something that was fairly interesting before we went on air, is that you said that the ABC people, the people who want to do away with prevailing wage, they've gone away from, they've stopped at the state level. Where in Pennsylvania, ABC and all of the right-wing think tanks are pushing for this on the state level because Republicans control everything in Pennsylvania.
Right.
California is different. So what they've done here in California, going down to the local level to try and get individual things done away with prevailing wage. Can you explain a little bit of that?
Yeah, so basically what's happened is there are super majorities for the Democrats in both houses of the state legislature, and we have a Democratic governor. So that makes it very difficult for people on the more right side of the political spectrum to get much done in California right now, or even slow it down in some cases. And what's happened is that groups are going to the local level, specifically the ABC. They've had to go to the local level to try and make the changes that they feel they want to make, and in this case that means they're going to cities and doing presentations and council meetings and trying to convince them that they can, by chartering, because we have general law cities and charter cities in California, just the brief
more
explanation
charters
of that. And if you charter, you have the option to eliminate prevailing wage. And they're trying to convince, in some cases, cities that only have a few thousand people in them to charter, completely change their form of government. And the reason that the ABC wants them to do this is eliminate prevailing wage. And, we're trying to educate people in those communities as to what that really means for them and to why it is important that they don't let it happen.
I listen to this, and you think about the amount of money that they spend on this. Where do they benefit from doing away with prevailing wage. I would think if you have a level playing field where everyone's competing on quality, on service, on the product, on delivering on your word, not on how much we can screw people out of wages, benefits, or have unsafe conditions, you would think everyone would want to compete on that plan.
Yes, you would.
So why would they want to spend all of this money to, well, I guess the answer is pretty simple. The only way they can compete is through cheating people out of wages and benefits and having conditions
right.
that...
You would think that it's a profit motive somewhere down the line. I mean, that's the only thing that I can imagine.
Because I'm trying to find out where the money's at. They say follow the money.
Right.
You know, why would they be spending all this money if they weren't going to benefit from it?
Exactly.
My old man always said something to me, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it.
Because, he was a smart guy.
Because that guy that had the buck, he didn't get that buck by being stupid.
Right.
He understands return on investment. And when I see the ABC saying, oh, this is wonderful, workers, watch your wallets.
Pretty simple stuff.
Dale, I appreciate the time. SmartCitiesPrevail.org, the website. We're going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around from San Jose, California, here at Netroots Nation. The People's Tour for America continues. Right back.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
So Rick's off to Florida with his family. We'll be playing encore performances of the People's Tour right through the new year.
No, wait, I'm still here.
Rick, what are you doing here?
Well, Pat, I wanted to make sure that we were playing the People's Tour while I'm gone.
Rick, you and everyone else can rest assured that each night from 9 until midnight, we'll hear some of the very best interviews from our trip across the country, exploring labor history.
Right here, 9 to midnight, on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The low-wage workers' movement that's been grabbing headlines across the United States went to the Netroots Nation Conference in San Jose, California on Saturday. Rasheen Aldridge told the audience his stories of working for a Jimmy John's franchisee in St. Louis.
We get harassed at these jobs day in and day out. I don't know if you guys read, but at my store, I had to hold a sign up that said I made 3 wrong sandwiches. And another coworker had to hold a sign that said she was 13 seconds in drive-thru.
Aldridge said an increase in wages and guaranteed hours are necessary so workers can pay their bills and feed their families.
I'm pretty sure all those people in Jimmy John's are going to take that money and put it towards their bills that they can start to pay, put it towards their detergent, or put it towards their kids, put it towards the student loans that they have to pay back.
The Las Vegas Strip was backed up on June 14th as union workers protested in front of the Cosmopolitan Hotel and Casino for the third time this year. Jasmine Lopez reports on the purpose of the rally.
Hundreds of workers from across the Las Vegas Valley, members of the Culinary Workers Union and the Bartenders Union, rallied outside of the Cosmopolitan Hotel and Casino. The demonstrations were in response to the expiration of and slow pace to extend 44,000 union contracts. June 14th marked the third demonstration this year, the first set of protests in a decade.
Okay, my name is Michelle DiManzo. I'm a cashier at the Wicked Spoon in the Cosmopolitan Hotel. The reason we're rallying is because we want to have a contract. We've been negotiating for at least 2 years now for our health benefits that are very important, guaranteed work week, and successorship. The hotel is up for sale, and we want to make sure that we have our guaranteed jobs if the company is sold.
Members of the Culinary Workers Union have been fighting the Cosmopolitan and Deutsche Bank for what they say is the same standard of living as the rest of the Strip workers. They have also been trying to organize station casinos, partly owned by Deutsche Bank. In October, the National Labor Relations Board found station casinos to have violated federal labor law in dozens of cases, the largest number of unfair labor practices committed by a single employer in the history of Nevada gaming.
I am here because we need a guaranteed work week. We need a fair medical plan.
That was Cash O'Brien, a banquet server at the Cosmopolitan and a committee leader for the Culinary Workers Union. We spoke with O'Brien at union headquarters.
We're wanting to make sure that families are allowed to feed their children. We're wanting to make sure that families are allowed to have the proper health care for their family. That's not going to cost them half their paycheck. It's fair, it's right, it's just, and we want to keep it that way.
the Cosmopolitan declined to interview.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the People's Tour for America on the road. You can find out where we've been, where we're going, peoplestourforamerica.com. So we've kind of been doing the tourist thing as well. We went to what I call the biggest pothole in the world with the Grand Canyon. And, you know, I was thinking about this today, you know, as we were coming into the studio, coming into Radio Row here at Netroots Nation. So there's a Niagara Falls in Pennsylvania. Bushkill Falls is the Niagara Falls of Pennsylvania. Maybe Governor Corbett's not funding infrastructure. Maybe the idea is with the 42 sinkholes we've had in Harrisburg over the last year, maybe the idea is to create a Grand Canyon of Pennsylvania. Could be the streets of Harrisburg. What a great tourist opportunity. Here to talk a little bit about tourism out here in California, where we're at for Netroots Nation, is Corrine Wilson. She's a research and policy lead at the Center on Policy Initiatives in San Diego. Corrine, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
So what do you think? Defund all infrastructure, let it go straight to pot. Maybe Pennsylvania's got a shot at being the Grand Canyon of the East. Because, you know, our governor wants Pennsylvania to be the Texas of the Northeast. Why not the Arizona, too?
I think so. I think you can take on the whole Southwest, and that would just be great. You'd be the Southwest, except with snow. Or I think it's freezing rain. Is that right?
Well, certain parts.
Certain parts. Excellent. Yes.
We've got all kinds of weather.
Lucky you.
Mostly bad.
And that's why you come out here.
Oh, this is beautiful.
Isn't it nice?
You know, we went through Arizona and Nevada, and we're going, who lives in these places? It's ungodly hot. And then we got to Los Angeles, going, wow, this is much better. Got here to San Jose, even better yet.
Oh, yeah. Northern California. It's got beautiful weather. Yes. However, in San Diego, we are a tourism hotspot, as you know. We've got SeaWorld. We've got the zoo. We've got Legoland. We've got all sorts of things just for the tourists. No, that's not true.
We did the whole San Diego Zoo thing.
Isn't it great?
It was wonderful.
It's beautiful.
We love
it's amazing.
Zoos.
Yes.
I've got three kids. We love going to the zoo.
Mm-hmm. And it's a great conservation place. They're bringing animals back from the brink.
So, well, that's...
That is a good thing.
Do we really need it? They're going to be extinct anyway.
I know.
So, why bother?
Yeah, well...
So, who funds the zoo? I mean, I guess
the
question...
Who funds the zoo?
You know, how's the zoo funded?
The zoo is funded mainly, I think, it's from memberships, user fees, people coming by. There is a little bit of government money. Taxpayers do help out some, but it's mainly a foundation and... It's a nonprofit, and we're taking care of the animals.
So that's what's wrong with it. See, if we could privatize
right.
it and profitize it,
exactly.
it would be much better.
Probably something having to do with Smithfield Foods, right? China's going to start doing tigers and pandas?
Yeah. And why not?
Yes.
You know, we've got these big rich hunters who go around the world and you know, basically walk into a pen and shoot endangered animals. Why not? We could use the San Diego Zoo.
Oh, good Lord.
It'd be a good profit motive opportunity.
Well, it would probably become even more self-sustaining than it is now.
Yeah, but all your animals would probably get killed. That probably wouldn't be good for the tourists.
Yeah, it's really a short-term solution.
Yeah. But, no, you look at this stuff, and while we're joking on this, you know, these are very important, I think very important assets that the area has, because it does draw people like my family to come see them, and it is good for the local economy. It's good for California in general, because this is a huge tourism state.
It is a huge tourism state. One of the things we're working on in San Diego is addressing tourism. It is in the top three, accommodation and food service, according to the census. That's the industry sector. It is one of our top three employment sectors in San Diego County. And the problem is that I did some research last year on census data, and the real median wages for a person in the accommodation and food service industry for the last 5 years, they have been making less than $25,000 a year, and their wages have stagnated. So from 2007 to 2011, if you're working full-time, year-round, cleaning somebody's hotel room, serving food, you are making less than $25,000 a year.
And why is that?
Why is that? Because we're just not paying enough. They really are minimum wage jobs, and you cannot make ends meet making a minimum wage job in San Diego County.
And again, you go back to why is that? I think back to my grandparents, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my grandfather started off as a truck driver. I came back from World War II, making virtually nothing. My grandmother started working in a department store, virtually nothing in wages. They organized. My grandfather was a Teamster for many years. My grandmother, a UFCW member. By the mid 70s, their mortgage was a joke. It was a day's pay, because
exactly.
They had organized and they had made those jobs that paid nothing sustainable.
Exactly, and that's what we need to do. We do have some good organizing happening in San Diego. It's not enough. Unfortunately, what we see in San Diego is that we're spending a lot of money on the tourism industry. We are sending taxpayer dollars to support the tourism industry because we feel that it brings outside dollars in. We capture outside dollars, but then we're giving them back out in basically social assistance. You're
welfare.
Seeing welfare. I don't like calling it welfare.
Corporate welfare.
Exactly. We are giving it out in corporate welfare. So what we're looking at in San Diego is fighting back. We have a new mayor. The former Congressman Bob Filner is now the new mayor of San Diego, and he is taking on the tourism industry head on. There is, years ago, we have basically a 2% tax, room rate tax, that goes to the city. And a couple years ago, again...
don't tell me. They gave it back to
the hoteliers. So it's called the Tourism Marketing District. So this 2% goes to market San Diego across the country. So if you're watching TV, you're listening to the radio, come visit San Diego. Come see the zoo, et cetera, et cetera. Come give us your money. We'd love to see you on our beaches. We gave it back. The city of San Diego gave control of the funds back to the hoteliers, back to the folks that are making money on it already.
Promoting themselves, not necessarily the city, because it would be my thought that you would want to promote the city as a whole, not one individual entity or one tourist attraction, or am I off?
Well, it's actually a kind of a hotel association. They're coming together. It's the tourism and the visitor Convis. It's the visitors association. Kind of a trade association. And so they are. It's the whole region. They're marketing the whole region. Come to San Diego. We have everything that you'd want for a sunny vacation, except that we're not paying the workers who interact with you enough to actually make ends meet, especially if they have a family. So Mayor Filner said, I don't like this agreement. I'm not going to sign the contract.
Nice.
I'm not going to sign the contract unless you pay living wages to your workers.
Beautiful. See, if we can get a president to think like that, that would be fantastic. Because I think anytime you're using city or state or federal money, it should come with a, hey, we're not leading the race to the bottom. We want to make sure that the people that are doing these jobs can actually participate and maybe even go to those attractions.
Exactly.
Occasionally.
Well, exactly. And actually, those people who work there should be able to stay at home with their kids on evenings or on weekends and not have to pick up extra jobs. And
that's a little bit much to ask for.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, they should be there to help them with homework, I think, but not at $8 an hour. But I agree that they should be able to go to the attractions where they're working or where their relatives are working, but not at $8 an hour. So Mayor Filner really upset a lot of people.
I can imagine.
Yes. And they actually, there's been rumor about a recall. He was just elected in November.
See, this is the reason that I'm not a big fan of recalls. Because then you start doing it for everybody and everything. And anytime, a group is upset, now you start talking about recalls.
Exactly. Well, actually, in California, we love to take everything to the ballot. If somebody didn't like sneezing, I think they'd put it on the ballot and see if they could recall it. It feels like it takes a lot to put something on the ballot, but it doesn't. We are government by the people, really. That's why we have so many restrictions on how government can raise funds. So I've been working on looking at infrastructure municipal infrastructure, and we cities do not have the ability to raise enough money to take care of our infrastructure. So,
well, we see the same thing in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. So
the
we,
state refuses to do anything.
So we're going to end up with our own sinkholes if we're not careful, which I'm not looking forward to that.
Yeah, I think you said the municipal swimming pools?
Municipal swimming pools.
More of every, on every
They're naturally occurring if you don't maintain your infrastructure.
Nice.
Yes.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're Corrine Wilson. She's the research and policy lead at the Center on Policy Initiatives. We're here at the NetRoots Nations Radio Row here in San Jose, California. You know, Corrine, you look at all of this, and it's, you know, I look at what you're saying. I'm going, you know, from a very conservative view, well, why do we have to have any of these problems? We could just privatize all of it, let private interests do it, and we wouldn't have to think about it. It would just be done.
No.
Because the private for-profit corporations, they would do it all. Because that's the magic bean. Privatization is the magic bean.
You know, you would think so. Except that nobody wants to pay for sidewalks.
We could have a toll walk.
A toll walk, yeah. Then we'd never get anywhere. No, it's actually a really interesting thing. I don't know how other states deal with it. Sidewalks are a weird thing in California. First of all, of course, nobody walks in California.
So why do you need them?
Yeah, this is really the point, yes. And that's why potholes are a problem, because everyone drives. But in California, for example, sidewalks, by state law, sidewalks are the liability of and responsibility of the property owner. So what what cities are doing is either they end up being the deep pocket that gets sued if there's a trip and fall, for example, or they're making the cities go out and they actually repair the sidewalk and then they bill the homeowner, or the property owner, which if you're low income or you're struggling, or I mean I think I make a pretty decent wage, but if I had to pay for my sidewalk, that would be something that I hadn't been thinking about. So privatizing something like a sidewalk, not sure I'd want to do that, because I might maintain my sidewalk, but my neighbor doesn't.
No, I'm with you. But, you know, I have friends who they view what goes on as everything should be for the private interest. Nothing should be in the hands of we the people.
Right.
And you should be billed as the homeowner. If you want to buy a house, you know that, you know, that sidewalk is your responsibility. And, oh, by the way, maybe half of the road that's in front of your house as well. And we do those things. We bill people. We do all of that stuff. And I guess the question is that the world we want to live in?
No. And actually, I should have led with this. We actually successfully stopped the privatization of operations of the only publicly managed and owned landfill in San Diego County that was up for privatization a couple years ago. You know, nobody thinks about where their trash goes, and it's really important. It's a huge environmental risk, and nobody wants to site a new landfill next door to them.
Not my backyard.
No, exactly. But our trash has to go somewhere.
Dump it in the ocean like New York does.
Exactly. Yes. No. That would ruin our tourism industry. Remember, what are we doing in San Diego?
But you could go on a treasure hunt like they do in New York. Hypodermic needles on the shore right there.
Oh, yay, fun.
Reuse and recycle. There you go.
Yes. It's piercing for free. So it's interesting what we're doing in San Diego, or what we were looking at doing in San Diego. It's the things that were being looked at for privatization are the enterprise funds of the city often. It's the things that actually bring us money. And yet, because they bring us money, they seem very attractive to privatize.
Yeah.
But it turns out nobody really wants to take over landfill operations when you have to adhere to very stringent environmental standards. The city of San Diego is doing really well on recycling. We have an amazing greenery. Citizens of San Diego, like, we compost. Okay, so you take
so
everything.
My wife.
Yeah. But we do it on a huge scale.
There you go.
Citizens of San Diego, you can go down and get 2 cubic yards of compost for free anytime you want, right? Really great. We have a lot of community gardens. We have community gardens at the school districts. But the private companies that were coming out to look at to operate our landfill, they don't have a greenery operation like that. So either get rid of the greenery operation, which was being looked at,
or charge for the compost.
Or just get, well, actually, they were looking at getting rid of it.
Oh.
Or, yes, charging. There's a, I think it's a group in Texas that actually does. They charge for the compost. So they bag it up, and you can come by and pay for the compost that basically, yeah, came out of your own backyard anyway and went to the landfill. So it's a pretty amazing what landfills, now I now know way too much about landfills, and they're beautiful things.
And now I do, too.
Yeah.
And do we put poles and pipes in the ground so we can capture the methane
and
reuse that energy?
Yes, with a private company.
Oh, okay. Well, hey. Yes.
But we're still
re-energy. Most of them aren't.
And, you know, that methane is actually being used to power our sewage treatment plant. How cool is that?
That is cool.
And our landfill is right next to Miramar Air Station, and they're actually using some of the methane to power the military base.
Positive
it's a win-win,
solutions.
I'm telling you.
We don't need to be drilling and fracking and all of that.
No, we can just go harness all of our old trash.
Sounds like a win-win solution to
me.
It
works for me.
And we don't even have to privatize that. Corrine Wilson, we appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a quick break from Netroots Nation here in San Jose, California. Quick break, right back after this.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history. Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the anti-immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours and a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.rickSmithShow.com.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone, by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. Also see where we're going and what the plan is from there. Lots of pictures, lots of opportunities to interact with the program. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, all of that right there. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. So while we're here at Netroots Nation, I'm having a great time talking to people, learning a whole bunch of new things about, you know, how are we going to turn the country around? How are we going to make this a country truly of, for, and by we the people? I'm sitting here with Blaine Rummel. He's a senior advisor for the folks at In the Public Interest, their website, inthepublicinterest.org. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Blaine, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So tell me, In the Public Interest, what is it?
What is it? In the Public Interest is an organization that is an information clearinghouse. It's a bit of a think tank, but with an organizer mentality. It's an organization that looks at, that wants to talk about the good that government does in people's lives. We think that for the past 40 years, the right wing has had, too much say in leading people to think that government is ultimately a bad thing. The truth is, many of us know it isn't. Many of us have gone to public schools, public universities. We've seen the good the government does. And so In the Public Interest wants to highlight that. And even more importantly, as part of that work, point out what happens when corporations take over public services and taxpayers lose control.
So when we privatize, and this is a perfect issue right now, because Pennsylvania is talking about the Republicans in Pennsylvania want to sell off the wine and spirit shops.
Right.
They want to sell off the lottery. Basically anything that's not nailed down, they want to privatize. And I've been saying for the longest time, and I've been challenging my listeners for the 8 years I've been on the air, to show me something that we've privatized that has, one, been cost-effective, and two, and most importantly, benefited me and
right.
my family and my fellow citizens.
Right. I think that when you look at public services that have been privatized, the companies will always come in and say, government should be run like a business, and we can do things better, faster, and cheaper. Not only is that not the case, but what you have to look at, the devil is always in the details with these things. When you start looking at contracts, the contracts that these governments are signing with big private companies, look at Chicago. A few years ago, Chicago privatized their parking meters. 36,000 parking meters were privatized. They signed a contract for 75 years. That contract has now not only led to prices being jacked up to $6.50 to park often for an hour in Chicago. Morgan Stanley owns the contract. But that contract included non-compete clauses. What does that mean? The city of Chicago is not allowed for the next 75 years to build public parking lots in the city because Morgan Stanley believes that they would compete with the parking meters.
Well, let me ask you. I get the no new parking structures. Can Chicago bring in public transportation? Because I know, like, there's a contract in Pittsburgh, the exact same thing you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But they've also got a clause in there that if you put public transportation routes in, we can sue you for those people who aren't bringing their cars in.
It's really unbelievable. I mean, the graft here is unbelievable. The same thing has happened in Denver. They privatize a tollway, the Northwest Parkway in Denver. And the contract says that local governments cannot make upgrades to the free public roads around. That. I mean, this is unbelievable, but it's happening, and these kinds of stories are common in America today, unfortunately. And so what In the Public Interest is committed to doing is to raising attention on these egregious giveaways. We're going to be doing a lot of that online and calling attention to them.
You know, one of the things that I've been saying is, you know, I have friends who say we should pay for all of the things that we use.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to pay taxes. And this is one of the right-wing Tea Party ideology.
Right.
We don't want to pay taxes. We should just pay for everything that we use.
Right.
And you go, well, okay, let's imagine your mailbox, since you want to destroy the post office, let's imagine the mailbox full of everything that we use, the roads, the bridges, all of the military, the police, the fire, all of that. Imagine getting a bill and having to write a check every month or every day reaching into your pocket. That's what conservative world or this business-friendly world is leading us towards.
Right, and it really is absurd. Now, it's interesting because you mentioned the Tea Party, and one of the things that In the Public Interest is committed to doing is, you know, I personally don't agree with the Tea Party on much of anything, but in a state like Ohio, what's going on there is Governor Kasich came in and he privatized economic development for the state. He set up an agency called Jobs Ohio, and it was a private entity. It became a slush fund. Money went missing, and when questions started to be raised, they rammed a bill through the legislature just recently saying that Jobs Ohio was not subject to open records requests. Progress Ohio, which is a great organization, progressive organization in Ohio, has actually teamed up with the Tea Party, and they're going to be arguing that case before the Ohio Supreme Court this summer. So I think that when it comes to outsourcing public services, it often isn't a left or right issue. I think that we all can agree as Americans that we reject crony capitalism and that we need to make sure that local taxpayers are in control of their services.
That's an excellent point, because, you know, I do have some Tea Party friends who, when you sit down and you talk, you know, face to face, not in big numbers, when you have these one-to-one conversations, they do believe that we should have a public fire department, a public police department, that there are things for the common good. The sad reality is, the last 30 years, the message has been nothing is for the common good. Everything should be for a profit, and everything should be for me, the individual. So what you're talking about doing is bringing us back to the idea of community, of the commons, things that we all share.
Absolutely. I mean, we need to reclaim the idea that we as a community own and want to control certain things, our public health and safety, for example. And when you have a private corporation come in, and their number one goal is profit. And hey, any business is free to go and try to make a profit, right? It's America.
But should we have a profit off of public goods, off the commons?
No.
Taking care of my grandmother, feeding hungry children,
no.
Protecting us. No profit?
No, not on those things. I mean, we need to look at the fact that when a company comes in and takes over EMS, for example, we got to think about this, because it's really scary. What kind of corners are they going to cut when it comes to emergency services in order to make a profit? I mean, they are in this to make a profit. And when that happens, local taxpayers are on the hook for making sure that they get a profit. I'll give you another example. The private prison industry, and in fact, in the public interest, we'll have a report coming out on this in September. The private prison industry comes in and takes over prisons or builds prisons. Those prisons are built for them to make a profit. The reason that they're able to make a profit is because many of their contracts include what are called bed guarantees. That basically, what a bed guarantee is the contract says that the state has to guarantee that the prison is 90, even 100% filled, or else taxpayers are on the hook for paying for those empty beds. Now think about that. That either means that we are putting people in jail because the private prison industry has a contract,
we might as well lock them
right?
Up.
Or taxpayers are wasting money on empty beds. That is just flat out un-American, and companies should not be in here making profit off the public good.
But what happened to rehabilitation? I mean, I thought prison. You went to prison. You did your time. You got rehabilitated. You got out. That doesn't seem to fit much into the private profit motive, does it?
It doesn't. I mean, because at the end of the day, these private companies make money by keeping people in prison as long as they can.
And lobbying for three strikes and you're out, and lobbying for mandatory sentencing and longer sentencing for really, you know, especially when you start talking about drug crimes, and that's a whole another discussion for another day. Mm-hmm. But you start talking about lesser crimes.
Right.
It's profit motive. I mean, in Pennsylvania, you know, you had the cash for kids thing that went up in Scranton.
Right.
Where, you know, we're locking up kids because, hey, you know, we're getting a kickback from the
right.
private industry.
And the private prison companies make a lot of money on immigration detention centers. Now, no matter where you are on immigration reform, they have been out there lobbying to block immigration reform because they want to keep people in detention centers because they're making money.
Man, you know, I look at this, and, you know, because I'm glad finally somebody is out here talking about this, because, you know, we've been saying, you know, when you're talking about privatizing things, what is in the public good does privatizing the wine and spirit shops or the lottery or prisons or the fire department? I don't know if you saw the story a couple years ago in Orion County, Tennessee, the private, you know, fire department showed up, said, hey, you didn't pay your subscription, your house is going to burn to the ground.
Right, right.
And you go, is that the world we want to live in?
Right, and I think that the research shows that we don't want to live in that world. I think that what we have needed to do, and hopefully what in the public interest is going to be doing very loudly, is pointing out these egregious horror stories that of privatization efforts that go wrong, and making sure that people see the good that government does.
You know, and that's an important thing, that we start we start talking about the good that government does. You know, government doesn't have an ad agency to go out and say and toot its own horn.
Right.
What we do have is a well-funded group that's trying to destroy them by advertising every time something goes wrong. And look, I want to know when things are going wrong with my government. But I also want to know what's going right.
Absolutely. And the thing of it is when you do find out when things are going wrong with government, because this is a democracy and there are systems of accountability. We can hold our elected officials accountable. We can vote them out. When a company comes in, decisions affecting public safety are made in secret. They are not subject to open records laws like government agencies are. You can't vote a CEO out of office or a Wall Street banker out of office. What happens is a company comes in, sets up a monopoly over public services, and taxpayers are powerless.
Yeah, and the other part of it is we don't know when things go wrong until things go really wrong. And I look at the banking industry as that. Do you want those people running our public service?
Exactly. And so we will be launching a legislative agenda, a proactive legislative agenda, called the Taxpayer Empowerment Agenda. And in fact, one of the planks will be that any company that has a contract with the government must open up their records and books just like any public entity has to.
Outstanding. And what I would like to see, and maybe this is part of your platform, maybe, I don't know, and if you want to see the website, in the publicinterest.org is the website. Just click on Blaine Rummel's name. It'll take you right there. I would like to see some, I believe government should be the people who raise standards. I don't want the government to be the leader in the race to the bottom. So if we do privatize and if we do these things that have been going on over the years, there's got to be a minimum standard, a reasonable wage, something where people have a little dignity on the job, some health care, retirement, something. There's
right.
got to be a floor.
That it's a really good point, and actually a couple of other planks that will be part of our legislative agenda, and we have actually done some research into the support of these. The number one plank that people support the most is that if a service is going to be privatized, the private company has to pay their workers a living wage and reasonable benefits. Along with that, studies have to be conducted on the broader community impact of what it will mean for privatization. What does it mean, for example, if you bring in workers, reduce their wages, take away their health care, and they can no longer afford to go to the local movie theater or out to dinner or pay for their kids' dance classes? This is not just about, you know, saving a few pennies, which ultimately doesn't happen anyway. This is about wrecking entire communities. And so taxpayers really need to know what's going on when we're talking about this kind of stuff.
Last line of questioning I've got for you, because you look at it, bringing this back to Pennsylvania. And I know you probably don't know all the specifics, but they're talking about privatizing the wine and spirit shops right now. An asset that the taxpayers of the Commonwealth hold brings in about $500 million in tax revenue every year. That's $500 million that me as a taxpayer, I don't have to pay. They want to give this away for who knows what because they can't give me a number. I look at this and I go, you know, what good is it going to do the public as a whole?
Right.
Walmart's going to benefit. The big box chain retailer stores, they're going to benefit. Does it make any sense to not have any rational regulation on this? And my other point is why bother doing it at all? Because it works.
Right. Right. No, you have to look at it. If I'm a taxpayer in Pennsylvania, my parents still live in Pennsylvania. I went to Penn State. I'm a PA boy through and through. But you look at what the revenue that raises is then reinvested back in Pennsylvania into services, into education. When you privatize or when you outsource public services, the money goes into the coffers of some corporation. And many of these corporations, and I don't know Pennsylvania specifically, but many of the ones that take over things like roads and bridges aren't even based in the United States.
The lottery of people, Camelot Global.
Exactly. And so why are we as taxpayers going to sign on to something where our dollars are no longer invested in our communities, but go into the pockets of Wall Street bankers or go into companies that are based in France or Dubai or wherever they might be?
Yeah, I look at when our governor tried to privatize the lottery. I went to a company in the UK, Camelot Global, and they actually incorporated in Delaware.
Yeah.
I mean, that just, it's amazing.
It is.
But I'm glad to see that this is going on. We would love to have you back on early and often as this goes down the road, because I think this is vital and this is important work you guys are doing.
Thank you for giving some attention.
Thanks, Blaine. The website, again, in the publicinterest.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Blaine Rummel's name. Quick break, right back from the People's Tour for America here in San Jose, California. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Don't sell us out!
Smith Show.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
So Rick's off to Florida with his family, and we'll be playing encore performances of the People's Tour right through the new year.
No, wait, I'm still here.
Rick, what are you doing here?
Well, Pat, I wanted to make sure that we were playing the People's Tour while I'm gone.
Rick, you and everyone else can rest assured that each night from 9 until midnight, we'll hear some of the very best interviews from our trip across the country, exploring labor history.
Right here, 9 to midnight, on the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The low-wage workers' movement that's been grabbing headlines across the United States went to the Netroots Nation Conference in San Jose, California on Saturday. Rasheen Aldridge told the audience his stories of working for a Jimmy John's franchisee in St. Louis.
We get harassed at these jobs day in and day out. I don't know if you guys read, but at my store, I had to hold a sign up that said I made 3 wrong sandwiches, and another coworker had to hold a sign that said she was 13 seconds in drive-thru.
Aldridge said an increase in wages and guaranteed hours are necessary so workers can pay their bills and feed their families.
I'm pretty sure all those people in Jimmy John's are going to take that money and put it towards their bills that they can start to pay, put it towards their detergent, or put it towards their kids, put it towards the student loans that they have to pay back.
The Las Vegas Strip was backed up on June 14th as union workers protested in front of the Cosmopolitan Hotel and Casino for the third time this year. Jasmine Lopez reports on the purpose of the rally.
Hundreds of workers from across the Las Vegas Valley, members of the Culinary Workers Union and the Bartenders Union, rallied outside of the Cosmopolitan Hotel and Casino. The demonstrations were in response to the expiration of and slow pace to extend 44,000 union contracts. June 14th marked the third demonstration this year, the first set of protests in a decade.
Okay, my name is Michelle DiManzo. I'm a cashier at the Wicked Spoon and the Cosmopolitan Hotel. The reason we're rallying is because we want to have our contract. We've been negotiating for at least 2 years now for our health benefits that are very important, guaranteed work week, and successorship. The hotel is up for sale, and we want to make sure that we have our guaranteed jobs if the company is sold.
Members of the Culinary Workers Union have been fighting the Cosmopolitan and Deutsche Bank for what they say is the same standard of living as the rest of the Strip workers. They have also been trying to organize station casinos, partly owned by Deutsche Bank. In October, the National Labor Relations Board found station casinos to have violated federal labor law in dozens of cases, the largest number of unfair labor practices committed by a single employer in the history of Nevada gaming.
I am here because we need a guaranteed work week. We need a fair medical plan.
That was Cash O'Brien, a banquet server at the Cosmopolitan and a committee leader for the Culinary Workers Union. We spoke with O'Brien at union headquarters.
We want to make sure that families are allowed to feed their children. We're wanting to make sure that families are allowed to have the proper health care for their family that's not going to cost them half their paycheck. It's fair, it's right, it's just, and we want to keep it that way.
The Cosmopolitan declined to interview.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. The People's Tour for America in San Jose, California for Netroots Nation. Pat, what'd you think of San Jose?
Well, it's in the heart of Silicon Valley, which was kind of interesting. The city itself was beautiful. Did you walk around the downtown at all?
We did.
The reason we don't know much about each other is we were doing separate things together. I was off kind of collecting information for the book. You were doing some of these other interviews. But I got a chance to wander around. And there, because of the Silicon Valley nature and the big companies there, Google, Apple, all the other companies, there's a huge support for the arts. So what might have one opera house in a town that big has 4 opera houses.
Wow.
And playhouses and places to see musicals. And, I mean, absolutely Art Deco, gorgeous places. And then you turn a corner and, yep, you got your Latrine Street, you know, the street that the whole street smells exactly like an awful lot of people are living there. But I couldn't see them. You know, it's like, do they have, I'm going to have to look this up when we get home, do they have ordinances against the homeless there? Are the homeless forced into hiding as they are in most big cities? I certainly never saw a panhandler. I didn't see a single sign of poverty, but you could smell it.
Yeah, but you would think in the place that's home to Google and Silicon Valley and all of the wealth and the opulence, you would think that, you know, there would be places of you know, amazing places for the homeless to stay. In fact, maybe so much would they wouldn't even be homeless that they would have jobs.
Well, I think that you can expect people to have jobs, but certainly you're not going to work at Google if you've only made it to 10th grade, unless you've got some amazing capacity for computer science without any kind of training. Now, I think that, you know, there's an underclass everywhere, and an awful lot of the homeless, contrary to popular belief, already have jobs. They just have bad paying jobs, poorly paying jobs. Certainly, you can work at a McDonald's, take home your $210 a week and not be able to afford to live in San Jose or pretty much any other city in the United States.
Well, and that's why, you know, here later in the program, we're going to talk to a security guard, a security officer, who they're trying to organize so that they can make a decent wage, so that they're not one of those homeless people that's employed. It's one of those things. We're going to take a quick break. Back from the People's Tour for America, San Jose, California, for Netroots Nation. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com or PeoplesTourForAmerica.com. Quick break, right back.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
What do you give a guy who has everything?
Labor history, of course.
And where can you get a great dose of labor history?
Right here, weeknights from 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show.
From New York City factories to West Virginia coal mines to Oregon loading docks to Toledo glass factories, you'll hear all the stories right here, right up until the new year.
And then we'll be back with all new shows here on The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raising, but the way it is.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So as we're going through here and we're talking with people from progressive groups, we're talking to people from labor groups, talking about the issues, kind of what we've been doing on the program from its inception. We talked with retail workers, with fast food workers, and now I want to sit down and talk here with Manny Cardenas. He's a security officer at Google, a multi-billion-dollar corporation, who, it's amazing to me, you've still got low-wage workers in a place that makes billions of dollars. Manny Cardenas, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I understand on Thursday they had an action where the security officer said, you know what, we want to make sure that we have some dignity, a little respect on the job. Tell me about the event that you guys held on Thursday.
So on Thursday, we had a petition. We had 3,500 signatures from community members and everyone that supported us to get a union for our security guards. And we were trying to deliver it to Larry Page. So a bunch of us went on campus. We marched on to the Google main campus, and as we tried to see Larry Page to give him the petition, we were stopped by a manager. He didn't allow us to see Larry Page. He said we didn't have an appointment. He said he would deliver the message for us, but he didn't give us any follow-up information to confirm that he would do so.
Yeah, this is the thing that's always blown my mind, and I've talked to a number of security officers over the years doing this program. In fact, you know, years ago, I was a security officer right when I got out of college. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me that you have these billion-dollar corporations like Google that they think that it's in the best interest of their company to have people guarding their multi-billion-dollar assets with people who can barely put food on the table. Absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah, to me, if they were to invest in the workers, they would use that money and put it back into the economy. So it's a good investment. So I don't see why they're not doing that.
Not to mention that you would get qualified people who are going to stay. You know, it always amazed me that you would go into some of these places when, in my personal experience, where there was such a fast turnover of security personnel in these big facilities where they'd be there a couple of weeks, and by the time they got trained, they were moving on to somewhere else. It doesn't, from a business perspective, it makes no sense to me that you would have such conditions where people are constantly leaving.
Yeah, and I agree.
Tell me about the conditions. I mean, we look at Google and people think this is an iconic American corporation, global corporation. Tell me about the conditions there.
So we're all hired on as part-time flex officers,
which is
on call. So,
on call.
Yeah. So if they call you, they have a shift. Sometimes they don't have any shifts for that week, so you don't get paid. You have to earn your full time. There's no guidelines how you earn full time. It's just when a position opens, everyone applies for it.
So if you have a brown nose,
yeah,
maybe you get full time. Or
there's no guidelines.
Nobody knows.
So. Without being full-time, we don't get benefits. And I have a daughter, I have a 4-year-old daughter, so, you know, that was a big deal for me. I needed benefits for her.
Let me ask you, what do you do now? I mean, this is one of the questions that I've asked a number of times as someone who doesn't have health care, who works.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do now if your daughter gets sick?
So I had to sign her up for Medi-Cal, which is run by the state.
One of the most powerful corporations in the country, on the planet,
yeah,
making billions of dollars, and their employee has to go to the taxpayers
mm-hmm.
to get health care for their kids. Doesn't that seem odd? Doesn't that thing seem wrong to you?
Yeah, it does, and that's why I'm speaking out about it.
And I give you credit. I mean, it's to me, what you're doing takes enormous bravery and courage, because here is a multinational corporation, a global behemoth,
mm-hmm.
and you're a guy who's just trying to raise your kid.
Yeah.
Just trying to get a decent day's pay for an honest day's work. Let me go back to the on-call part.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get like a notice, like a 2-hour work call? What's the situation when they call?
It could be anywhere. The shift could have actually already started, and they might.
Already started.
Yeah, and they might.
So they call you at 3:00 in the morning. Say, we need you here now.
Yeah.
And you rush right over. You've probably been up all day long. How safe is that?
Well, it's not an ideal situation at all.
Well, it's not ideal, but the question is how safe. Because, look, I mean, as you're in a position where if something goes wrong, you better be on top of your game.
Yeah. I don't feel it's safe. I mean, I could be tired, crash on the road, you know, so.
So as you're moving, as you delivered this petition, what's the ask? You know, what are you asking Google to do? What are you asking this company to do?
So we're asking Google to take responsibility and have a contractor that will allow us to have a union, as their janitors do. Their janitors they supported their janitors to have a union, and they have good working conditions and enough hours and benefits, and that's what I'm asking for. That's what we're asking for.
So at this point, they've got the petition.
Mm-hmm.
What's the next step?
We have to wait and see what their response is.
And what are we expecting some type of a response? I mean, have they, because one of the questions that always comes up in these organizing drives is, how's the company going to react?
Yeah.
Do they react by having surveillance on their employees and firing some and disciplining and doing all of the union-busting things that a number of companies have done?
Mm-hmm.
Or what?
Well, we hope that they react positively, as they did with the janitors. You know, they were one of the leaders that stepped up and supported them and set the foundation for other janitorial services. So we hope that they'll do that with us.
So how long have you been a security officer at Google?
At Google, since July 2012.
And how long have you been doing this as a career?
2008.
So you've been doing this a while. You're qualified to do it.
Yeah.
And to me, I look at this, and, you know, it's almost criminal to me
mm-hmm.
that you've got to go to the state to look for health care. You've got to struggle to make ends meet when you're working for a living.
Yeah.
And there's this company. Billions of dollars. It doesn't make any sense to me. As you're talking to your coworkers,
mm-hmm.
what kind of response are you getting from them? What kind of turnout did you get in the event on Thursday?
A lot of them are scared because, you know, it's intimidating. We're not supposed to talk about the union.
Do you get that in your introduction when you hire on? Is there at Google, do they have like I've heard at Walmart, they have a whole section in their initiation on why the union's bad and mm-hmm. why you shouldn't talk to those people. Do you get that at Google?
It's not that. They don't specifically name the union. But if a rep is around, you know, we're told to tell them to leave. They can't be on private property. So they never get a chance to talk to the union reps about the union. And so, you know, a lot of them are scared because they can be fired without cause right now.
I understand that completely, which is why I said I'm in awe of the bravery and courage that it takes to step forward and, yeah. and be willing to do this because, you know, like you said, you know, they can fire you for any reason.
Mm-hmm.
That's at-will employment in just about every state.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about your last line of questioning, your personal view on this and how you came to joining this and wanting to form a union. Mm-hmm. Do you have any union background?
No.
So this just, you know, hey, I've been treated in a crummy way. We want a better life. We want something better. This is a way to stand with our coworkers and make things a little bit better.
Yeah, a union rep came to one of my friends, actually. He was working at, contracted with BTA, and that was in 2010. So that's when I started hearing about the union. And, you know, I'm just one person. If I were to ask this big company for what I want, they won't listen. They don't have to listen. So if we form a union and have a lot of people come together as a collective, then they have to listen to us. And it made sense to me.
And I think you've hit the nail on the head. Why we see these big companies wanting to destroy unions and neuter their ability to organize. And I give you nothing but the utmost credit. I wish you the best in your pursuits, and I hope you win this.
Thank you.
Manny, thanks so much. Manny Cardenas, security officer over at Google. I mean, just... Google. Wow. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Hi, I'm Rick Smith.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
Thanks for listening to this encore performance of our People's Tour for America.
Gee, Rick, just listening to the show makes me feel warmer.
Funny, Pat. I feel warmer, too.
Oh, Rick, you should feel warmer. You're in Florida right now on vacation with Carol and the kids.
That's right. But we'll be back after the new year with all new shows and some biting commentary for election year 2014.
I know I speak for everyone when I say I just can't wait.
The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
It's intimidating, but it's nothing we are willing to back down on, you know? I mean, we're not just out there fighting for our own rights. When we're out there fighting a company like Walmart, we're fighting for every associate they hire worldwide.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. If you've missed any of our coverage of Netroots Nation or the People's Tour for America, you can go to the website, therickssmithshow.com, or peoplestourforamerica.com. It's all right there. I'm sitting here with Janet Sparks. She is a Walmart associate, also part of the Our Walmart campaign, their website, forrespect.org. Janet, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
You know, that word associate always jumps out at me. And, you know, as we were saying off air a moment ago, I think that they use the word associate to void the idea that we're workers.
Yes.
That you're a worker. And I guess, you know, when you get into that whole family mentality, you know, maybe it's okay you abuse family members. I don't know.
Abuse in any form is not right.
I'm right there with you. But so how long have you been working at Walmart?
It'll be 8 years in August.
8 years. And you have an interesting story because you actually owned a business prior to Walmart coming to town, because we hear a lot of that. You know, mom and pop were doing just fine until Walmart came to town and put mom and pop out of business. You were literally mom.
Yes, I had a video store in Alabama, and Walmart got into in the early 90s, and Walmart got into the video business, and it completely changed the face of video business. They started selling. They were able to buy what they called sell through. They coined a special term even for Walmart. purchases from the studios. Sheltered was the term. And us mom and pop stores, we were rental price for the wholesale price. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. In fact, I know a guy who he had his own hardware store, and a pretty successful little hardware store in this small town. As soon as Walmart came to town, done. And much like you were saying with the videos, he said he couldn't even buy a pound of nails for what they were selling it for.
It was the same thing. In fact, the studios promised that the titles would hold their price for 2 years since they wanted to sell to Walmart. And instead, in no time, in less than a year, they were no longer holding their price within 3 months. And then many of the titles, the studios were trying to weigh whether they should sell it at sell-through or at rental price, which way would be better for them, you know. That's how, like wildfire, it went and completely changed the face of video mom-and-pop stores completely.
So as someone who ran a small business, you've got to have a unique perspective on how all this is working. Because, you know, we hear a lot from our politicians. We need to be more business friendly. We need to help small business. We need to do these things because, you know, you're the job creators. Yet everything we do in policy-wise seems to benefit these multi-state, multinational behemoths at the detriment of mom and pop.
It definitely does. Mom and pops disappear. They cannot compete, just as we were saying, just the cost. They cannot buy. I even tried to get a coalition of video stores in that area together to try to buy from the studios because we could not.
You have the purchasing power.
Right, and that was what they were comparing it to, what they could sell a bunch of mom-and-pop stores videos to or sell X number to Walmart, you know. And
it's just not videos. I mean, you go story after story. I mean,
exactly.
The classic pickle story. You know, it's classic. You know, bikes, you name the product, they've forced it overseas. And I keep asking the question, is that good for the country? I mean, is having this behemoth operating under this model, is it what's good for us?
No, I work in Louisiana, that's where I'm from, but I originally started in Pennsylvania working for Walmart, and I had a friend in the clothing business, you know, in the design and everything. And he was directly affected and ended up working with me at Walmart. He and I started the same day, in fact, back in 2005. And all the clothing manufacturers were going overseas, and we know how that's ended up. You know, all of our jobs have ended up overseas. The unsafe conditions, I just spoke at the shareholders meeting, and the lady from Bangladesh was speaking concerning the fire in November and the collapse of the factory
in Bangladesh.
Right. And all of our jobs have left here, so we have no jobs, plus the safety and all the precautions that were already set up in this country to protect people, all that is gone. Because these, you know, why? To get the lowest price that they could sell at the highest profit.
So let me ask you this.
So that's profit over people. I'm sorry.
Because, well, no, we see it. And it's right here in front of us. So whose fault is it? Is it Walmart's fault? Is it our government policy's fault? Is it our fault for shopping there in those kind of places? You know, where do you
It's
go?
A combination to me. It's all three. You know, people wanted the lowest prices, but they didn't foresee where this would go. They didn't even stop and think where this would go. It's the government's fault due to all the lobbying that was done to get all the trade agreements and everything. And, of course, it's big business for higher profit for corporate greed, you know. So I feel it's a combination of all of it, and look where it's brought us to. And we've got to change it.
Yeah, I'm with you. The government policy end of it, these trade agreements are absolutely insane, Janet. And, you know, from the Walmart part, I got to be honest, they're doing what we're allowing them to do. You know, this idea that they're going to be a benevolent corporation, no corporation is benevolent. They're in business for one reason, and that's to make as much profit as possible. And I go back to when I was a kid, my grandmother was an associate, if you will. She worked at a little department store called Uncle Bill's in Cleveland. In the 80s, she was making $8 an hour with full benefits, full pension that she enjoys to this day in her retirement. It was 1985. Here we are, 2013. How many people in Walmart are making $8 an hour? How many have full benefits? How many have 6 weeks vacation? How many have dental insurance and eye insurance? How many people have those things?
The store I work at, they start at $7.90 an hour. Here it is, 2013. And they definitely do not have benefits. You know, I'm one of the few that still does, the old full-time.
So I go back to maybe it's us. You know, why do we support those companies? Why?
Well, that's you're asking one of my when I started this I started trying to do this by myself back in 2006 when Walmart changed, and that was one of my things. We've got to educate the associates of their rights, the shareholders of the unfair labor practices of Walmart, and the customers of the high cost of the low prices that they're paying. They're not seeing the cost. And through this organization United for Respect at Walmart, we are doing those three things. And the customers are seeing, you know, sure they may be saving $5 on this item or $150 on that TV, but they're not seeing that their taxes are higher due to all Walmart employees. The majority of Walmart employees are on every type of government assistance. So they're saving right here in their left hand, but they're putting it out through
from
their
the
taxes,
yeah.
And they didn't know. They don't know. So education of the customers, the associates, and the shareholders is the answer. And then when you have all the facts, you can make an educated decision. Now,
but can we make an education at this point now? Can we make that decision? Because, you know, I've had people make the argument is, well, you want to buy American-made products, Rick, and I do. I'm a big supporter of Buy American. But when you go into places like Walmart or Target or any of them, the products aren't there anymore because we've allowed the behemoths to force those out. So I don't really have a choice.
I say, yeah, that's what I keep, you know, this is going to take time to turn it around, you know.
And it's going to take us demanding.
Exactly. And, you know, educate, demand, and, you know, and accomplish it. We cannot grow weary in the walk to accomplish this, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we're in this together. And, you know, if we allow you to be exploited, just like the fast food workers, just like the security officers, if we allow you guys to be, we're all going to be there.
That's right.
I mean, it never gets old for me, the old labor saying an injury to one is an injury to all, because it's true. We are all in this together.
And that's what it's going to take, every one of us working together. I have no problem with corporations having high profit. None. I was in business myself, like I said. But I have a problem with it being to the expense of the people working. And the expense of the customers going through their taxes. And, you know, I do have a problem.
I'm a fan of saying I want a company to make a profit, but I also want the workers to profit.
That's right.
Make a living, not a killing.
Exactly. You
and
know,
I look at the six Waltons, and this is something you could probably talk about a little bit better than I can, but you've got six people who probably the hardest day's work they've ever done is making it through the birth canal. They control 40% of the wealth in this country. More than the bottom 40% of the population in this country, they have more wealth than that. Something's seriously wrong with that.
Yes, it is. And so, and you have to wonder then, is it does it come down to what does it take for you to do the right thing? You know, what does it take to open your eyes? What is it, you know, because I have seen I'm going to use the word aggressiveness toward this organization that Walmart
and the
Waltons have, right, you know. So
the story about them having a SWAT team on call in Bentonville with their own airplane coming anywhere where the dreaded U word ever comes up, is that true?
Yes, sir, you know, and this organization, they have call the police on us associates ourselves. You know, that's how...
Yeah, that makes you want to do a good day's work, huh?
That, you know, that really shows that...
That shows dedication to you there.
Right. You know, that shows I'm not an associate, you know. I am...
You're a tool.
Yes, you know, and an expendable tool. And it's, you know, and the associates who are speaking out like this, so many have been retaliated against that it is, you know, quite fearful to do it.
Have you seen retaliation?
I've seen retaliation. They have done it subtly to me, you know, but I've seen so many of my coworkers from across the country be retaliated against, and that's an unfair labor practice. And, you know, that shows you that they are comfortable with there being the six people having 40% of the whip.
They got their hands firmly on both hands on the wheel.
You know, I used to give the benefit of the doubt. They don't realize it. They don't understand. They're so separate. But now, after being almost 2 years in this organization and speaking out, I know that they know that they know. And instead of coming to us and saying, you know, let's see if we can change these things. Y'all are making sense. You know, instead there's more aggression.
Yeah.
There's more unfair labor practice of retaliation against associates speaking out. That's what we went on strike for at the shareholders meeting. And since then there has been more retaliation. Okay, and so there's more aggression, more retaliation. They see the picture, and they're comfortable with it, obviously.
Yeah, so in my view, some would say they just didn't realize. I like your angle. They didn't realize, so we're going to have to inform them. I would make the argument that they knew from the beginning exactly what they wanted, and they're exactly where they wanted to be. All of these have been conscious choices.
Right.
It's just now we're waking up to them.
That's what I'm waking up to.
So
I really believe, like I told you, that they didn't know.
They know.
You know, let me educate them, you know.
And I think it's a, you know, whatever got you here, you're here. So let's talk about the campaign. I've got about a minute left. You know, what is the OurWalmartForRespect.org? What is the campaign?
It's Organization United for Respect at Walmart, and we call it Our Walmart for short. And it's an organization for associates, by associates. We are working, like I said, to educate associates and customers and shareholders of...
I get that, but
you know,
what's the end result? What do we want?
To change Walmart, to change the way they have gone into scheduling, the way they have gone into the pay... the way they have gone from full-time to part-time, and now they're going to temporary workers.
Yeah.
They're going to have workers.
Because we got to avoid the Affordable Care Act.
Yes, and they're going to have temporary workers for like 180 days, from what I understand, and they're not going to, you know, they're cutting out paying health insurance by making sure they don't have full-time workers and have workers work for less than 30 hours a week. They supported Obamacare. And they obviously had this plan,
yep.
You know, and now they've announced that if you're working under 30 hours, you will not be offered insurance in 2014. We're trying to change all the problems that associates face every day.
Well, I give you credit because I think what you're doing is courageous. I think you're brave for doing it, standing up in the face of this huge multinational behemoth. I give you nothing but credit, and I appreciate that you do.
Thank you. Thank you for everything.
Janet Sparks, quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history. Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you've missed any of our coverage of Netroots Nation, go to the website there at therickSmithShow.com. If you've missed any of our coverage of the People's Tour for America, PeoplesTourForAmerica.com, you can find out where we've been, where we're going, pictures, interviews, everything right there at the website, PeoplesTourForAmerica.com. So we're here at Netroots Nation. I've got Yolanda Cruz. She's the president of AFSCME Local 101 here in the city of San Jose. Yolanda, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us into your city.
Oh, thank you.
What a beautiful place.
Thank you for coming. It is. It's a very beautiful place.
We have really enjoyed our time here as we're traveling across country, talking about history, talking about the history of work in this country, mm-hmm. finding so many incredible stories and talking to so many incredible public servants, of which we've met a couple here in San Jose mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, it's great. We've got a big, very progressive community here.
So, what the mainstream media keeps pointing out, keeps telling us, like Yolanda's, there's something wrong with you're greedy and you want pensions and you want a decent wage. And somehow you've been cast as the one who's destroying America. You're destroying America.
Exactly. And it's totally wrong. It's the absolute wrong thing.
How do you not go? Because if it were me, I would be screaming in the streets. I would, every chance I got, I would be just... I do these things for the public good. I'm a public servant. I'm the guy who screwed this up.
Right. Yeah. The problem is that our mayor in the city of San Jose here has capitalized on a lot of national sentiment, and he's just really attacking the workers, and it's very sad because the community doesn't even understand. We're having a very difficult time getting any media coverage that is of any
value. That's because they own the media.
Yes, it's true.
I mean, the sad reality is, in past years, the very wealthy in this country, they didn't have control of all of the message.
Exactly.
Now you see the Koch brothers are going to buy the biggest papers in the country mm-hmm. when they're telling us that newspapers are failing and they're unsustainable. Why are they doing that? Because they want the message.
Control the message.
Because they don't want to hear what a great job you and your members do for the citizens. All they want to do is focus on, well, there's somebody who screwed up, and that's why we should throw them all away.
Exactly. It's very unfortunate.
But the thing is you talk about your mayor here. It's just not here.
No.
It's all over the country. I mean, it's this national plan, and it may sound conspiratorial, but they have done a remarkable job of convincing people like me that my neighbor... screwing things up.
I know. It's very bad. I think if people were to stop and think about the services that they rely upon, the services that help make a community. So we represent library workers. We do all, we check out all the materials. We're the librarians. We are 911 dispatchers. So we're, in the community constantly. We do code enforcement inspections. We're also planners who approve business plans and other things so that we can have a vibrant community, and they just lump all government workers as lazy, and that's not the case here.
See,
in San Jose,
those are all jobs I wouldn't have even thought of, because you think of the firefighters, there's a huge fire truck mm-hmm. here in the convention center of saying, hey, look what we do for the community. You think of cops and teachers, librarians and the people working in city offices. I don't think that much about because they do their jobs.
Right. And, there's when they say it takes a village to raise a child, that's really what it is. I mean, we need police officers. We need firefighters. But we also need people who outreach positively to the community. Not that police and fire don't. They do. They do a tremendous job. But
that's
we need
to have their unions do that.
Yes.
And, the thing is do public workers, do they have a Madison Avenue PR firm to
no.
tout how wonderful? Because I know the right spends an awful lot of money when something goes wrong.
Yeah.
Is there anybody spending any money out there saying, hey, you guys did a great job today. Thanks a lot for coming.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, that's not the case. And that is that's the biggest challenge, I think, that we have. And it has to be a grassroots thing. And I talk to my members regularly telling them, you need to speak out in the communities and in the areas that you're involved in and tell people what you do and how important it is, the services are that you provide. Because, like you said, most people don't even think about what public workers do for in the area.
Because the message is always, it's just bad.
Mm-hmm.
And where I'm from in Pennsylvania, we've got a government who's hell-bent on destroying anything held by we the people. Mm-hmm. If there's anything that we do for ourselves as part of the commons, you know, like roads and bridges and mm-hmm. cops and fire and education, all that stuff, they want to do away with.
Exactly.
And to me, I've been asking for the, said it a couple times here on the program, can you show me anything we've privatized that we put into the hands of these profiteers that's benefited me?
Yeah.
Because the costs haven't gone down, and the service sure as hell hasn't gotten any better.
Right.
Explain it to me, because I'm missing it. Or is it just purely ideological that we hate people who make a decent wage?
I don't think that that's really what the case is, but I think that, you know, the business community or the business is these very rich people want to take control of everything. And they plug us as being, you know, very... thinking that we are entitlement, so we have entitlement to things. And that's not the case. We know that here in the city of San Jose, I represent 3,000 workers. We represent the largest part of the workforce. And more than half of my members are unbenefited part-time workers. So they you know, we are very supportive of education in helping college students and high school students be able to learn how to be workers and how to be engaged in the community, and also working around their school schedules so that we can encourage people to have that education and build more. But what this mayor has said is, you know, everything's so expensive and the workers, yeah, public workers are public enemy number one. I mean, at one point he was actually saying that. And I, along with the other bargaining units in the city of San Jose, went to him and said, that's an insult.
It is an insult. I mean, how do you go to work, and why would you want to go to work and do your best if the guy you're working for is kicking you in the behind every chance he gets?
You know, it's not for him. We do it for the residents of San Jose. And although he tries to say that we don't care about stuff, we care very much about the residents. And it's because
you are residents.
We are residents, but we're also very... We made conscious decisions. Many of us made very conscious decisions to become public servants. Back in San Jose, in California, but in San Jose specifically, the dot-com boom was just going crazy. And we, you know, there were opportunities for people to do different things, but we made decisions to come and be public servants. And I started working in a library, and I loved it. I started out as a clerk, and I've worked my way up through a very competitive process. You know, and now I manage the computer system that they use to check out all the materials. So we work hard, and I've given up a lot, as have other workers, for the good of the citizens. And this mayor saying that we don't care is just an insult. But we don't do it for him. We do it for the residents of San Jose.
And you know, Yolanda, as we're doing this tour across the country, and we're talking to a number of workers, and we're talking to people all over the country, I'm really struck when I talk to public sector workers how that's the sentiment. We took this job to serve the public. We could have made money where we've got a sufficient education to make money somewhere else. We could have gotten a better job. But you know what? It really is about that public service. And that seems to be a central tenet of almost everybody we talk to. Even the sanitation workers in Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we do this because it's for the good of the public.
Right. Right. I think it comes down to there are a lot of things that need to happen in order for a city to be vibrant. And a business is important, and, you know, having different things available. But our residents depend upon library services. They depend upon community centers to provide, you know, different things for children. Yeah, recreation.
And what I find amazing, and I've seen a lot of cities who are trying to attract business, mm-hmm. what they do, and this just blows my mind, because I don't know how you, with being as Janus-faced as this is, say on one hand my public sector workers are horrible and they're destroying everything, and then going to these businesses saying, look how wonderful our public services are.
Right, right.
Do you see a disconnect there?
I see a tremendous disconnect. I think they, you know, what they try and say is that the businesses are what's going to bring this community back. And again, there's this place for everybody. And when when they degrade services so much. We used to have, we have a brand new public library. We've been very progressive in things that we've done. We've won national, you know, awards for this, and we're the one of the only joint libraries in all of the nation. So we've joined forces with San Jose State University so that we've expanded resources not only to the citizens but to the students and have made it more available to them. We have 17 branch libraries with the opening of another few more so that at the end of next year we should have 22 branch libraries open. But this mayor has cut the hours from 6 days to 4 days a week. The citizens are angry. They're upset about that. But we said all along that one of the challenges that's going to happen is the employees are going to be overworked because the citizens will adjust their lifestyles to meet the schedules that they have. So we haven't seen a decrease in services.
But here's the thing, and this is what drives me insane. You know, as you're laying this out, as you're saying we're going down from 6 days to 4 days, we're cutting services, we're cutting. Even if you buy that we're business friendly, even if you buy this idea, we're just acting like a business. What business slashes their product? What business reduces their access to their product? It makes no sense to me whatsoever, Yolanda.
It makes no sense. And what this mayor has done is just create an environment that makes it is difficult for employees to come to work. And on any given day, you know, employees are very frustrated. But when we talk to each other and we figure out what's going on, we say, we don't do this for him. We do it for the residents. And we do it for the children. We do it for the families. And we do it for our families and everybody who needs this stuff.
So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, I don't know how you motivate people. You know, as president of Local 101 here, you know, one of your jobs, obviously, is to keep your members motivated and all of that. How do you continue to do that? I mean, I know you're doing a fantastic job. I've heard great things. How do you do that with all of the attacks, all of the media attention, with all of this vitriol towards public sector workers?
You know, for us personally, it's become extremely difficult. But, again, it's the commitment of the individual employee. And we tell them that this is an unfortunate situation that we're in, but he is thankfully going to be termed out of office at the end of of 2014, and we're hoping that we will get more progressive elected leaders who will be back actually representing the communities. So community is more than just the businesses. You need to be able to help the people.
I'm right there with you. Yolanda Cruz, I appreciate you taking time and sitting down talking
Thank
with
you.
Us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. Back with the People's Tour for America from San Jose, California, here at Netroots Nation. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
So Rick's off to Florida with his family. We'll be playing encore performances of the People's Tour right through the new year.
No, wait, I'm still here.
Rick, what are you doing here?
Well, Pat, I wanted to make sure that we were playing the People's Tour while I'm gone.
Rick, you and everyone else can rest assured that each night from 9 until midnight, we'll hear some of the very best interviews from our trip across the country, exploring labor history.
Right here, 9 to midnight, on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
January of 1964 was a time to remember for many Americans. The Beatles released their first album. New York announced plans to build a World Trade Center. The Surgeon General announced smoking kills, and President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty during his first State of the Union address. January 1964 was also a momentous year for the American truck drivers. The nation's truckers saw the first nationwide labor contract. The National Master Freight Agreement, covering some 450,000 truck drivers employed by 16,000 companies across the country, set a nationwide minimum wage of $3.33 per hour, or $23.63 in 2008 dollars, as well as providing health care and retirement benefits for all its members. The 1964 National Master Freight Agreement set a nationwide standard for working conditions, giving drivers a voice on the job and the power to stand up to abusive treatment, and eventually the ability to refuse to drive equipment the driver deemed unsafe. Led by labor visionary James R. Hoffa, this victory was the crowning achievement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, as one of America's most influential unions. This landmark agreement created a framework for all national contracts to follow. Jimmy Hoffa, the man who famously quipped, "I may have many faults, being wrong is not one of them," was certainly right about the benefits, power, and influence of such a national agreement for workers, both union and non-union. Wages and benefits earned by truck drivers brought millions of hardworking men and women solidly into the middle class by rewarding hard work with a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. For generations, the National Master Freight Agreement served as the industry standard for all truck drivers, raising wages, improving benefits, and providing a safer workplace for drivers and the motoring public. Unfortunately, since the 1980 passage of trucking deregulation, the industry has resorted to cutthroat competition based on who is willing to work for less. In this environment, the National Master Freight Agreement has lost some of its power in lifting truck drivers out of low wage, no benefit, and hazardous conditions. Currently, many non-union truck drivers are earning at or near poverty wages while pushing legal limits. For many truckers, their pay is solely determined by the number of miles they drive. Breakdowns, time spent waiting to be loaded and unloaded, and other delays are shouldered by the driver, in most cases without compensation. 1964 and the years that followed has shown what can be accomplished by workers standing together. Perhaps the future will see resurgence in worker solidarity and the reemergence of a fair day's work, a fair day's pay. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here at Netroots Nation in San Jose, California. The People's Tour for America rolled in, I guess what, last night a little bit. When we were over at the Golden Gate Bridge, did the march there with the good folks at National Nurses United, calling for the, well, I call it the Tobin tax, the transaction tax. They call it the Robin Hood tax, which I think is probably just as good of an analogy to take from the people who stole from us and invest in roads and bridges and healthcare and education and all those things that we used to invest in. But here at the conference, you run into so many great people, and I'm sitting here with Ruth Morris. She is the director of training at Progressive Change Committee. They've just launched the P100 campaign. Ruth, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks, Rick.
What is the P100 campaign?
So the P100 is a project, a training project of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, or the boldprogressives.org. So PCCC has been around for 4 years, and we launched in 2009 with the express mission to support bold progressive candidates. So we're a national progressive organization that's about elevating the voices and the policies that work for American people, that are bold progressive issues that the majority of Americans support, they want to see happen, but the politics today doesn't necessarily make the obvious space for it. But bold progressive candidates are the people that are carving out that space.
Right.
People like Mark Takano, people like Alan Grayson, people like Keith Ellison, people like Elizabeth Warren. So Elizabeth Warren, I think, is a great example of what the PCCC is all about. We drafted Elizabeth to run in 2011, raised $100,000 for her campaign even before she had announced. And the premise of that was, like, we thought that she had, we could smell that she had a message that was resonating with American people, and that her policies were exactly the antidote to the fiscal crisis that rocked so many American working families in 2007, 2008, 2009, and for the decades before, were eviscerating the middle class. So we wanted to elevate that voice. We wanted to say, we think you have something here, and we think it is important for Massachusetts, but we also think it's something that is going to resonate across the country. So we supported Elizabeth to run, and when she announced, she got that $100,000, and then we were able to support her campaign very deeply and collaboratively in an intimate way. So that's, I think, really is a great example, a great illustration of what we do at boldprogressives.org and what we do at the PCCC. So the P100 training project is really geared at building capacity for that core theory of change.
Right.
We need more bold progressives.
You're going to run for office and we're...
That's right. I mean, your listeners across the country, right? They're all over the place.
Well, yeah, we have listeners all over the country.
Yeah. So your listeners have representatives right now that span a certain spectrum. Some of them might really represent the values of their families and the interests of their families, and some of them might just be the next Democrat that came along in that state or in that district.
Or some of them are insane, like my representative.
Locally. Is that right?
Well, Lou Barlotta is my congressman, and I got another
guy. And you wake up every morning and look at the paper and just, oh, palm to face.
Yeah. There's no representative. And the sad reality is that some of the Democrats that have run against him haven't been much better. Right. And, you know, the sad reality, and that, this is what I like about what you're saying, is that, you know, maybe there's a choice out there, because there's sometimes I vote for a Democrat, and there's really not much choice between him and the Republican.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've got so many of these DLC-type Democrats, these corporate pro-business Democrats, where you're going to go, I'm really not, if I wanted that, I'd vote for the Republican.
That's right. That's right. Well, and there's also been a trend that I think has been sort of self-perpetuating in a way, where Democrats sort of sell, some Democrats sell to the middle, and then they tell other Democrats, like, hey, this worked for us, like, we got some money back home to our district, or whatever their perceived benefit was of moving to the quote-unquote middle, and then they tell others, or they do it again. Their staff are trained and reaffirmed in that logic of political transaction, and we sort of say, no, you know, stop, dead end. We need to move back to a new path, new road. And selling to the middle is a false sort of perception. The idea that there are policies in the middle that are anything but progressive is inaccurate.
Then where's the middle?
Right. Because the majority of Americans believe in economic equality.
Absolutely.
They want to see policies that support a level playing field and support the expansion and the growth and the support of the middle class and of the working class. So when we talk about center, left, and right, we're actually using a false paradigm. Right. So progressives, bold progressives, are candidates that run on the premise that our issues are issues that resonate with most Americans and that work for most Americans. So we're going to not apologize for those positions or moderate on those positions. We're going to campaign on them vehemently.
Absolutely. So I'm with you, because the sad reality is what I've noticed in a lot of my friends is it's turned into a team sport mentality. It's no longer about the issues. And what I like what you're saying, you're talking about issues that are important to the majority of countries, of people in this country. And instead of it's the Democrats or the Republicans, because I think we've gotten into this team sport mentality where, you know, a bad Democrat is still better than a Republican.
Right.
You still got a bad Democrat.
Yeah. And the old high school rivalry of, you know, if you don't remember the reason why you hate the other high school's basketball team, you just remember that you hate them.
Exactly. You know, as a kid growing up in Cleveland, I know I don't like Pittsburgh. I don't really know why. I just don't like Pittsburgh.
Right.
And it's the same thing, you know, when it comes to politics, I think.
Yeah, so these left and right issue positions, I mean, this is all kind of smoke and mirrors, because really, we 70% of Americans, 80% of Americans agree that we should tax the rich. And state to state, you know, there's some variation in some states where you might hit more like 65, you might be more like 80 in certain states. But most Americans want to see a ban on assault-style rifles and weapons. These are things that people agree on. So at the PCCC, we're looking for the issues and the policies that work for people, that win for candidates, and that are progressive for Americans. And we support those candidates to run. So the training project is the P100 program, which you can find at p100training.org, is all about training up-and-coming political staffers that can staff the campaigns that will elect the progressives. And we're experiencing a demographic shift in this country where county by county, district by district, and indeed in state by many important states, we're seeing the politics changing and moving more towards a populist, an economic populist position.
Well, because I think the younger generation is demanding that, because the younger generation is really getting screwed in every way you can imagine, because they're being saddled with massive amounts of student loan debt, unprecedented in this country. Mm-hmm. They're being harmed by a job market that's non-existent for them. So they went out, they spent all this money on an education. There's nothing waiting for them.
That's right.
Even though their whole lives are told that's the ticket to the middle class, well, you know what happened? Middle class has been destroyed.
And the policies that supported a healthy middle class, like affordable student loans. And so Elizabeth Warren, of course, is fighting for a just student loan rate, but she needs allies, right? So we're drafting Brian Schweitzer in Montana to run, who would be a great ally to Elizabeth in the Senate, would support issues like having fair student loan rates. But we can't stop there. So at the P100 Training Project, we need to take the potential of all of these emerging progressive districts and actually give them leadership, actually empower young up-and-coming staffers that don't just want to work for the next Democrat to come along.
They want to work for somebody
they want to
believe
work for the progressive.
Yeah, and I think that's fantastic, because, you know, I've worked on a number of campaigns where at the end of it you go, did I do the right thing?
Yeah.
And, you know, because this is where this is the next guy.
Yeah. Well, and there are people that spend a decade or more in electoral politics, and they look back and they have the same experience. Did I move the ball forward? Did I push the needle on the issues that matter to me? So P100 trainees are people that we think not only believe in progressive values, but that really have the smarts and the leadership and the tenacity and the innovative vision to lead their campaigns to win, but win on our issues.
And
right.
That's the important part. It's the issues. Ruth, it was great talking with you. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely.
This is a great conference. I'm always amazed at
meet a lot of great people.
That, yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Ruth Morrison, thanks so much. Quick break. Right back from San Jose, California. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Show, changing America for the better.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
So Rick's off to Florida with his family. We'll be playing encore performances of the People's Tour right through the new year.
No, wait, I'm still here.
Rick, what are you doing here?
Well, Pat, I wanted to make sure that we were playing the People's Tour while I'm gone.
Rick, you and everyone else can rest assured that each night from 9 until midnight, we'll hear some of the very best interviews from our trip across the country, exploring labor history.
Right here, 9 to midnight, on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The low-wage workers' movement that's been grabbing headlines across the United States went to the Netroots Nation Conference in San Jose, California on Saturday. Rasheen Aldridge told the audience his stories of working for a Jimmy John's franchisee in St. Louis.
We get harassed at these jobs day in and day out. I don't know if you guys read, but at my store, I had to hold a sign up that said I made 3 wrong sandwiches. And another coworker had to hold a sign that said she was 13 seconds in drive-thru.
Aldridge said an increase in wages and guaranteed hours are necessary so workers can pay their bills and feed their families.
I'm pretty sure all those people in Jimmy John's are going to take that money and put it towards their bills that they can start to pay, put it towards their detergent, or put it towards their kids, put it towards the student loans that they have to pay back.
The Las Vegas Strip was backed up on June 14th as union workers protested in front of the Cosmopolitan Hotel and Casino for the third time this year. Jasmine Lopez reports on the purpose of the rally.
Hundreds of workers from across the Las Vegas Valley, members of the Culinary Workers Union and the Bartenders Union, rallied outside of the Cosmopolitan Hotel and Casino. The demonstrations were in response to the expiration of and slow pace to extend 44,000 union contracts. June 14th marked the third demonstration this year, the first set of protests in a decade.
Okay, my name is Michelle DeManzo. I'm a cashier at the Wicked Spoon in the Cosmopolitan Hotel. The reason we're rallying is because we want to have a contract. We've been negotiating for at least 2 years now for our health benefits that are very important, guaranteed work week, and successorship. The hotel is up for sale, and we want to make sure that we have our guaranteed jobs if the company is sold.
Members of the Culinary Workers Union have been fighting the Cosmopolitan and Deutsche Bank for what they say is the same standard of living as the rest of the Strip workers. They have also been trying to organize station casinos, partly owned by Deutsche Bank. In October, the National Labor Relations Board found station casinos to have violated federal labor law in dozens of cases, the largest number of unfair labor practices committed by a single employer in the history of Nevada gaming.
I am here because we need a guaranteed work week. We need a fair medical plan.
That was Cash O'Brien, a banquet server at the Cosmopolitan and a committee leader for the Culinary Workers Union. We spoke with O'Brien at union headquarters.
We're wanting to make sure that families are allowed to feed their children. We're wanting to make sure that families are allowed to have the proper health care for their family that's not going to cost them half their paycheck. It's fair, it's right, it's just, and we want to keep it that way.
The Cosmopolitan declined to interview.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. The People's Tour for America has rolled into San Jose, California. We're here for Netroots Nation. You know, over the last several months, we've been talking about the fast food workers campaign to get a decent living wage. We've been talking about retail workers, you know, like my grandparents' generation, asking for a decent living wage, a little bit of health care, a little some benefits, you know, a little dignity, if you will. And on Friday, here at Netroots Nation, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, they have started this idea that, hey, you know what, maybe we should join all of those together and have a campaign, a coordinated campaign, to make sure that fast food workers and retail workers get a little justice on the job. The campaign Raise Up America. They're campaigning to raise the pay for American workers, strengthen the middle class, and you know what? Get the economy moving, which is something we've been talking about for quite some time on the program. One of the workers here for that campaign is Darius Chambers. He is from Detroit. He is a food worker. Darius, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. I'm glad to be here.
I guess the first question, how is San Jose different from Detroit?
Well, there's a few things, you know. First, I was really impressed by the cleanliness, you know. You ride down downtown Detroit, you're going to see a trash, and you're going to see a lot of it.
Why is that?
I don't know. I can't
blame Because we don't have workers to pick them up, maybe?
That could be
maybe we've laid all those people off.
That could be a reason.
You know, because for me, you know, you look at that and you're right. You see areas of high poverty.
Everywhere.
There's trash everywhere. And it's because there's nobody picking it up.
That's right.
You go into the nice areas that are like around here, they've got workers. And I've run into a couple of them who were paid a decent wage to pick up that
trash. That are scheduled
to do it. Exactly.
It's crazy.
And it's something we should be doing all across the country.
That's right.
We want to create jobs. There'd be a good start. Maybe clean up Detroit.
Yeah,
would be a good thing.
That would
as
be
well
good.
As well as Rise Up America. So let's talk about your job. What is it you do?
Well, I work at Tim Hortons Cafe and Bake Shop. It's really small, not too much work. We got less than 30 items on the menu. But I basically make sandwiches, mix coffee, and sell donuts all day. But
and that's good work, eh?
It's fine.
When I'm hungry, got a place to go.
It's fine, but I mean, on my end, 18 hours a week, less than 18 hours a week, with a 3-year-old child living in Detroit, Michigan, with no car, it's a whole different ball game.
So what are we asking for?
I mean, we need 15. If you look at it statistically, they told me that it cost about $14.85 to live at poverty wages in Detroit. We get paid $7.40. That's less than half. So we're like under poverty, you know what I mean? Somebody told me the other day he wasn't worried about unemployment. He was worried about underemployment. It's real out here. You know, we're not getting enough to do anything, you know?
And it's not just fast food work. It's not just retail. It seems to be the economy of the country.
It is.
And, you know, as I've been saying here on the program for some time, you know, the jobs that we look back to in the, you know, the 60s and the 70s as those good middle class jobs, the jobs working in factories and in mines and driving a truck and all of that stuff, you know, back in the 20s, 30s, and the 40s, those weren't good
paying
jobs.
They weren't good jobs, and they had to fight for those jobs to become good.
So when I see a campaign like Rise Up America, to me, this is the start of that.
We're reincarnating it.
Absolutely, where you need to get your brothers and sisters and everybody on the line and all your coworkers to say, you know what, we need to have some dignity and respect.
That's right. Somebody has to stand up for us.
Because I got to tell you, Darius, I have no idea how it is that someone can exist on minimum wage in this country as low as it's been allowed to go.
I know. It's wild. That's why I keep reinstating. It's crazy. We live in it. It's nuts.
And you back and you look at, you know, the Reagan administration, how they let inflation erode the minimum wage. You go through and you let Clinton allowed it to be eroded, and now President Obama he's done nothing in his 5 years to help that. To me, you know, his call for $9 he said recently?
Yep. Nine.
When originally he said 10?
Yep.
That's not even close to enough in my view.
It's not.
So, you know, when you look at this, the question then becomes, because, you know, my conservative listeners are going, well, why not just make it $100 an hour? Because businesses can't afford it.
Right.
Is that true? I mean, do you think that the company that you work for
totally
can afford
not
to
true.
Pay you in a reasonable wage?
In my city, we use a word called PROS, P-R-O-S. That's the sub for profits. McDonald's and Burger King accumulate $2.2 billion in pros every year. Every year, you know what I mean? And still paying people that are managers that's been there for like 8-10 years, $740 it's unprecedented. It's disrespectful.
So you say the managers are making the same wage. Isn't this an opportunity for the frontline workers, the cashiers, the fry cooks and the managers to all come together and say, you know what?
You would think so.
We want to. I saw a thing the other day that said that the CEO of McDonald's, if you worked for McDonald's and you wanted to make the same wage that the CEO made, you'd have to only work over a million hours. Do you think it's conceivably possible to work a million hours in a year?
I don't think it's conceivably possible to work $1 million at McDonald's.
Well, there aren't a million hours in the year.
Exactly.
Mathematically, it's not possible. But it's interesting to me that some think it's okay for the CEO to take that kind of money.
Right.
And leave everybody else
and
struggling
with,
to make
with
any
those
money.
With those unsound probabilities. Work for a million hours, we'll hook you up.
So how do you do it? I mean, you work 18 hours a week, basically minimum wage, because minimum wage is $7.40.
Exactly.
In Michigan.
Yep.
How do you get by?
Well, I mean, if I've never had to budget before, I have to now. You know, every dollar counts.
What happens if your three-year-old gets sick?
There's no answer for that.
What happens if you get sick?
There's no answer for that. I don't get enough hours to get benefits.
But you work for a living.
Right. We all do.
And this is the thing that, you know, you hear people say, well, you know, the people who get health care from the government or need food stamps or need some help or assistance, that they're lazy or shiftless. And that's been the message in Pennsylvania. I don't know how it is in Detroit.
Yeah, that's how they try to portray it. But, I mean, I work every day out of the week, you know. Like, they'll give me 17 hours, and it'll be 4 days out of the week.
So you can't even go somewhere else.
Exactly. If I don't make any extra money doing things like around the house or cutting somebody's yard or washing somebody's car, I barely get to see my daughter. I get to see my kid like twice a month because she lives in a different town.
I got to tell you, Darius, I don't know how you do it.
It's a lot to deal with.
But, you know, in looking at this, how do I help? How do our listeners help? Because, you know, most people look at it this way. You know, if you work for a living, if you're out there and you're busting your behind,
right,
you should be able to put a roof over your head. You should be able to put food on the table.
That's absolutely correct.
Give your kids maybe a better future. That's the American dream.
That's right.
The American way, in my view.
That's right.
So how do we help make that the reality?
Well, Netroots Nation right now and all these other sub-coalitions that are coming together to fight this monster right now, that's the thing. We're coming together. We're helping each other. So if this is something that you can see yourself getting into, or it's something that sounds like it'll be beneficial for the people that you love and you know in the future, then help out with it, you know? If you want to put your hand in the pot, put your arm in the pot. Go all the way for it, you know?
You know, as I've been saying, and, you know, one of the things that I think most of my listeners understand, Darius, is that if it happens to you, if I allow something to happen to you, if I allow you to be exploited, if I allow you to work in a job with crummy conditions and poor wages, eventually it's going to come back to us.
Exactly.
Because an injury to one, I truly believe, is an injury to all of us.
It is.
And I look at all of these companies who have started up on this model of, we're going to pay you minimum wage with no chance of health care or pensions, even though we're raking in huge amounts of money and we're paying our CEOs $8.75 million
right,
a year like they do to the guy at McDonald's. When we allow those kind of business models to be set up, it tears us all down.
That's right.
Instead of saying, you know what, set up a business model on a higher road where we're going to pay decent living wages.
And it's the situations that they're putting us in, it's like a double negative. If I don't get 40 hours a week, I don't get, like, medical assistance, right? But if my city has the highest crime rate right now and no EMS, how do I pay to help myself if something happens to me, let alone anybody that I know? You know, something has to change. We need a drastic change now. And from the standpoint that I was at, nobody was helping. So I decided to help myself.
So let's talk about the campaign. Raise Up America. What are they asking for?
They're basically asking that the minimum wage workers that are serious about making a movement, about making a change in America, that we step up and do it. I'm from Detroit. I'm in California. I woke up at 4:45 this morning to make sure that I was here to represent everything that's going on right now. This is a movement.
How are your coworkers viewing what's going on? I can't imagine. Look, when you're on the edge, I understand. When you're standing looking into the abyss where, hey, I've got this 18-hour-a-week minimum wage job, but, hey, you know what? At least I've got this. If I lose this, then where am I?
Right.
I understand that the hesitation. I understand the fear. But
right.
I'm curious, when you talk to them one-to-one, what kind of response are you getting back?
Well, they always, you know, are in agreement. Like, yeah, that's the right thing to do. You should do that. Maybe I should look into it. But I never get like a, yeah, let me get one of those cards and I'll meet you down there, you know, for a meeting. The first time that somebody displayed this to me and told me that we can make a change for the people that are living in the same situations as you, all you have to do is step up, I jumped.
Good for you. You know, and the thing is when I saw all this, and we've talked to numerous retail workers and fast food workers, every time there's a strike somewhere, whether it's in St. Louis or it's in Chicago or New York, no matter where it is, we get workers on to talk about it, because I think it's a Herculean labor. I think it takes the utmost bravery and courage.
It does.
To stand up and say, you know what, I'm on the edge, I'm looking over.
It does.
And I'm gonna try and make it better.
It does. I've got a manager. She is the only person in the store that gets 41 hours a week. You know what I mean? She shows up at 6 o'clock, gets off at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I begged her, you know, it's only going to get better for you. If it gets better for the small guy, it always gets better for the guy who's upstairs.
There you go.
She still didn't want to, you know, make that jump. She was afraid.
That's
what's holding us back.
Well, it's the fear. And I guess the question then becomes, how bad does it have to get before people act? I mean, do you have to be homeless? Do you have to be worse off?
Once these people that are within comfortability range drop from that, they'll finally realize it. You know, it's starting slowly in Michigan. First, we're losing safety, the most important thing. First, we're losing EMS trucks and you know what I mean, and cop cars. So if we have none of that, the crime is going to raise up. If nobody is working, they're looking for people who have money. They're going to take from the people who have money. So if you don't join this movement or try to do something, if you're living in a city like I'm in, you're in trouble. I would advise you to do something.
No, I'm with you. And it's all about all of us coming together and standing together.
It is. And if we don't, we're going to crumble. You can't make a movement with one person in a world of a billion people.
Last question I've got for you. When you go back, after all you've learned here at Netroots Nation and the people that you've talked to and the contacts you've made, what are you going to take back with you?
Well, basically, the best thing that I can do for my city as far as taking it back to Detroit is let people know that the stuff that you see every day, that's not it. You know what I mean? One step, you can get out there and get the same thing that everybody else is getting. It just takes initiative and time.
And it takes us standing together.
You have to.
Yeah, and I say this all the time. My grandparents' generation got it. When they came back from World War II, they got it. They fought fascism together. And you know what they also did? They built the largest middle class in the history of civilization.
Rick, people don't even know that.
Together. Darius Chambers, I appreciate the time. Thanks for talking with us.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
Going to take a quick break right back from San Jose, California, Netroots Nation, the People's Tour for America on the road. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
What do you give a guy who has everything?
Labor history, of course.
And where can you get a great dose of labor history?
Right here, weeknights from 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show.
From New York City factories to West Virginia coal mines to Oregon loading docks to Toledo glass factories, you'll hear all the stories right here, right up until the new year.
And then we'll be back with all new shows here on The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
On December 28, 1970, President Richard Nixon signed the Occupational Safety and Health Act into law. Thanks to strong lobbying efforts by union leaders over many years, this safety bill of rights established for the first time a comprehensive national policy to protect workers' health and safety. Effective April 28, 1971, employers were required to provide a workplace free of known hazards that caused or were likely to cause serious physical injury or death. Prior to the passage of OSHA, work-related injuries and deaths were extremely high. The 1920s saw reports of 20,000 workers killed on the job and more than 2.5 million injured per year. That number remained until the 1960s when work-related deaths dropped to 14,000 per year, but injuries increased by 20%. Today, thanks to OSHA, protections on-the-job injuries have fallen 40% and on-the-job deaths have been reduced by 60% pre-OSHA. OSHA is considered the first piece of legislation allowing the government to inspect and hold employers accountable for dangerous and physically harmful working conditions. OSHA has three branches, an enforcement branch, a research branch, and a review branch. Since its passage, OSHA has allowed for greater visibility and oversight in conditions on the job, prioritizing efforts to prevent accidents, control health hazards, and ensure workers go home as safe and as healthy as when they arrived on the job. While OSHA is a step in the right direction, there is still considerable work to be done, and only through the eyes and voices of working people with the help of their unions will tomorrow be a safer day. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therichsmithshow.com.
Keep reiterating that the students aren't going to take it. Like, we're not going to take it. Like, not in the literal sense, not in the literal sense. We need to have this solidarity.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. The People's Tour for America here in San Jose, California. We're sitting here with Ben Jealous. He's the president of the NAACP.
Hey, it's good to see you, Rick.
I appreciate you taking time for us, Ben. You know, we are on this labor history tour to kind of teach my children and educate our listeners of the history of the past of workers and the struggles, and took us through Memphis.
Yeah.
And we sat down with some of the sanitation workers that Dr. King died for.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things most people don't realize. Dr. King was in Memphis for those sanitation, those striking workers.
Fighting to make sure that they would have pensions, fighting to make sure they would have a living wage, fighting to make sure that they were respected as the men they were.
But here's the thing. You know, as we were talking about to those sanitation workers, to this day, they still don't have pensions. To this day, they're still under attack from privatization. They're still under attack. And, you know, the fight never ends. So while, you know, there are some who believe that we have all of these rights, the civil rights movement brought some equality, workers' rights struggle brought some betterment in wages, the fight continues.
Well, you know, when I was a young organizer working with labor, I've just been kicked out of school for organizing protests or fighting NAFTA. And we were taught that there's two types of power in this country. There's organized money and there's organized people. And the people can win every fight, but we have to be organized to do it. And the reality is that in the South, in these right-to-work states, being organized, staying organized is very difficult. The deck is really stacked against workers and their efforts to organize. And what's also forgotten is that the roots of organized black political power in this country really goes back to A. Philip Randolph and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters.
Yep.
And there in Memphis was a man named Bill Lucy. Bill had grown up in the East Bay in California, had come out there with AFSCME.
Something we've had on the program a number of times.
And Bill himself is is the product of a black political machine built by C.L. Dellums, who was one of A. Philip Randolph's lieutenants and Ron Dellums' uncle. And so I think that we in the black community, and I think we in the larger labor community, often forget just how joined our history is. My wife's grandfather was a steel worker in Denora, Pennsylvania. He was active in his union. He was president of the old Negro Social and Political Club. He's credited with desegregating the restaurants of Denora by himself with a pistol. He would You know, it was not uncommon for steel workers back then to carry small pistols because they were often changing shifts at midnight. And there were a lot of drunk, tough guys to walk through, right? Late at night. And so, and these towns had built-in ethnic tensions. You know, they, to try to thwart organizing, would bring people from parts of Europe that were in conflict with each other.
Right.
You know, they'd bring white guys from the South and black guys from the South, you know, and try to build an ethnic tension. And so, in that context, my wife's grandfather carried a pistol, and one day he's walking home and he's frustrated that everything seems to be desegregated in town, the schools, the stores, except for the restaurants and the churches. And so he stops in a diner and they ignore him, the whites only diner, they ignore him. So he puts his pistol on the table and all of a sudden they notice him and they serve him. And so he goes home and he calls his club secretary and he says, "Tomorrow I want all the club members as they get off the shift to go by Joe's Diner and celebrate the fact that I desegregated it today."
Nice.
In other words, the folks were afraid to show up for a protest because they might get fired at the factory. They had a protest. But the celebration would accomplish the same thing, right? And so, you know, I'm really glad that you're doing this tour, that you're telling these stories, because the story of labor is the story of the creation of the middle class in this country.
Absolutely.
And the future of labor is the future of the middle class in this country.
You know, and highlighting some of those, some of the people we've talked to on this tour, you know, we've seen those situations where they brought in people into the mines who were of a different ethnicity just for that tension.
Yep.
Because what's happened in the wealth class of this country, and it goes back to the old Jay Gould quote, "I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half."
Right.
They've always used that tension. They've always subdivided us and pitted us against one another. And one of the things that I, in going through Memphis and learning about more about Dr. King and the struggles that went on, that kind of push for economic and social justice, I see we need more now today than ever.
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, quite frankly, somebody needs to start an honest conversation about the state of working class and underemployed white men in this country. It's really startling when you walk into the prison systems, as I do across this country. We have as many white men in prison as we have black men.
But that's not what we hear in the media.
Right. Well, because what you talk about in this country is we focus on the disparities. We focus on the racial horse race. We say, oh, well, there's black men's much more likely to be in prison than a white man. That's true, about five times. But there's about five times as many white men as there are black men. So as organizers, we have to focus on the actual numbers. And
right.
Say we have a similar number of white families and black families that can be organized out of their pure self-interest to make sure that we're treating, for instance, poor drug addicts the same way that we treat rich drug addicts. You know, if you're a rich addict, we say, brother, you need Betty Ford. If you're a poor addict, we say, you better get your butt in prison. We're dragging you down there right now. We destroy your family. We send your kids to foster care. And we give you a scarlet F for felon when you get out and you can't get a job. And, you know, in this country in the last decade, just to give you an example, black men have gone from being about almost four times as likely as a black man in South Africa at the height of apartheid to be incarcerated, to be about three and a half times. So still massively overrepresented in prison, even by apartheid standards in South Africa. But white men have gone from being half as likely as a black man in South Africa at the height of apartheid to be incarcerated to being three quarters as likely. And
how much do you think of that is the private prison industry that we've made locking people up a profit motive?
Well, the private prison industry makes itself an obstacle to the reduction of prisons. You can't blame them too much for the laws that were passed to increase.
You can't. I would say the money that we've given them, they've lobbied for these type of laws because, hey, we've got these people who can't find jobs. We've made these communities, these desperate communities, high in poverty, and those are folks just ripe for
right.
to fill our beds.
But the funny thing is that they start off as vultures. They start off coming to a tragedy that's already being created.
Good point.
Then once they're there, the vultures, if you will, become guardians of the status quo because they profit off the status quo. They want to make sure there's a high volume of carcasses. And so, you know, our job now, absolutely we have to fight the prison industry, but quite frankly, we have to have an honest conversation amongst working people in this country because it's, you know, what's common about the people behind bars is that they're hugely, almost exclusively from the ranks of the working and poor people. And so they foment, the guards foment racial division in the prisons themselves. And we, as people who organize working people, need to be able to stand up and say, hey, we got about a million white families in this country with somebody they love behind bars, and about a million black families in this country. The rates are going up for white folks. They're holding kind of stagnant for blacks, but either way, it's a bad situation, and let's solve it. Because drug rehab, for instance, is 7 times more effective dollar for dollar than incarceration. And the crazy part is this, right? College tuition in California went up 78% last year. Now, that doesn't really impact rich people. They can afford
it. It kills the middle class.
It kills working people.
And it puts lower-income people out of the realm of ever getting to it.
And those are the good kids from the families who are saying, well, that's not going to be my kid. Well, it's not going to be your kid behind bars, but it might be your kid who can't afford to go to college, or your kid who can't afford to pay off his loans, because you're subsidizing keeping other people's family in prison. Because in California, where we are today, say, 40 years ago, 3% of the state budget went to prisons and 11% went to public universities. In the currently proposed budget, according to a state senator I spoke to a couple months ago, it's now 15% for prisons and 6% for public universities.
Wow. That's amazing
and
stuff.
So it's important, I guess, that despite those divisions in our past, often intentionally exacerbated by the boss, if you will, it's important that today we do everything we can to reach out across those old divides, because what was true then is true now. We have more in common than we don't.
It goes back to the old saying, an injury to one is truly an injury to all. Yeah. Ben Jealous, I appreciate the time. Thanks for talking to us.
All right. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you so much. Going to take a quick break from Netroots Nation. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
What do you give a guy who has everything?
Labor history, of course.
And where can you get a great dose of labor history?
Right here, weeknights from 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show.
From New York City factories to West Virginia coal mines to Oregon loading docks to Toledo glass factories, you'll hear all the stories right here, right up until the new year.
And then we'll be back with all new shows here on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The low-wage workers' movement that's been grabbing headlines across the United States went to the Netroots Nation Conference in San Jose, California on Saturday. Rasheen Aldridge told the audience his stories of working for a Jimmy John's franchisee in St. Louis.
We get harassed at these jobs day in and day out. I don't know if you guys read, but at my store, I had to hold a sign up that said I made 3 wrong sandwiches. And another coworker had to hold a sign that said she was 13 seconds in drive-thru.
Aldridge said an increase in wages and guaranteed hours are necessary so workers can pay their bills and feed their families.
I'm pretty sure all those people in Jimmy John's are going to take that money and put it towards their bills that they can start to pay, put it towards their detergent, or put it towards their kids, put it towards the student loans that they have to pay back.
The Las Vegas Strip was backed up on June 14th as union workers protested in front of the Cosmopolitan Hotel and Casino for the third time this year. Jasmine Lopez reports on the purpose of the rally.
Hundreds of workers from across the Las Vegas Valley, members of the Culinary Workers Union and the Bartenders Union, rallied outside of the Cosmopolitan Hotel and Casino. The demonstrations were in response to the expiration of and slow pace to extend 44,000 union contracts. June 14th marked the third demonstration this year, the first set of protests in a decade.
Okay, my name is Michelle DiManzo. I'm a cashier at the Wicked Spoon in the Cosmopolitan Hotel. The reason we're rallying is because we want to have a contract. We've been negotiating for at least 2 years now for our health benefits that are very important, guaranteed work week, and successorship. The hotel is up for sale, and we want to make sure that we have our guaranteed jobs if the company is sold.
Members of the Culinary Workers Union have been fighting the Cosmopolitan and Deutsche Bank for what they say is the same standard of living as the rest of the Strip workers. They have also been trying to organize station casinos, partly owned by Deutsche Bank. In October, the National Labor Relations Board found station casinos to have violated federal labor law in dozens of cases. the largest number of unfair labor practices committed by a single employer in the history of Nevada gaming.
I am here because we need a guaranteed work week. We need a fair medical plan.
That was Cash O'Brien, a banquet server at the Cosmopolitan and a committee leader for the Culinary Workers Union. We spoke with O'Brien at union headquarters.
We're wanting to make sure that families are allowed to feed their children. We're wanting to make sure that families are allowed to have the proper health care for their family. That's not going to cost them half their paycheck. It's fair, it's right, it's just, and we want to keep it that way.
The Cosmopolitan declined to interview.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. We're at Netroots Nation here in San Jose, California. Another stop along the People's Tour for America. I'm sitting here with Lily Eskelson-Garcia. She's a vice president at NEA, the National Education Association. Lily, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, I make time for you.
So what do you think of the Netroots Nation? What do you think of this conference?
This is such an amazing place to be, because these are the true believers in the middle class, in people, in those exotic things like your right to an education, your right to health care, your right to a decent living wage. And so you have people here. I'm a union, you know. NEA is a union of educators.
You mean the people who destroyed our economy?
Was that us?
That's what I'm told constantly. I'm told all the time it's you, it's the firefighters.
Yeah, all of those. Not those Wall Street bankers that actually played games with my pension funds, by the way. So everybody's 401k, everyone's pension, your little annuity, my mother's life savings in a money market account that my dad left her. All of that goes south because of a few greedy Wall Street people who were playing fast and loose with the truth and just destroyed the global economy. And what do they say? Oh, it was the teacher's pension fund. No, it was the teacher's pension fund that invested in those bad bundled securities.
And now what they're doing in Pennsylvania, I don't know if you know, but where we're from in Pennsylvania, we've got a governor who wants to now take those defined benefit plans, turn them into those magical things.
Magical, because we'll all get rich in the stock market.
Exactly.
How short do they think our memories are? Well, let's not just do that. Let's do that to Social Security.
Again.
Let's privatize Social Security. What we have to do is have these translators in our heads all the time. When someone says, you know, privatize, you can get rich, you need to hear, we want you to bear the risk. When we will not, by the way, and that happened because we didn't have the right laws watchdogging the people that we were trusting with our money and our parents' and grandparents' money, they don't want to watchdog Wall Street. So when they say those things, we need to hear, when they go south, we want you to bear the risk.
Yep.
Because they'll tell you they want you to get rich and have, you know, some nest egg to leave your grandchildren. You're going to be living with your grandchildren. They're going to be taking care of you because of these kinds of privatized plans.
You know, I keep going back to something my grandfather always said. He said, you know, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you look at this and all of this money being invested into telling me that this is good for me.
Right.
Telling me that, oh, this is good for society. It's good, like, with education. Mm-hmm. This whole push towards privatization,
right.
All of these charters and all of this move towards for-profit education. There's all this money telling me this is good.
And who's the messenger there? The same people that destroyed our economy. That anything that is public safety, public education, those are all bad things, because we have to think that government is bad and private is good. So something like public health, Medicare, is bad. Wouldn't that just be better if your parents could buy their own overpriced health insurance somewhere? And
we'll even give you a little golden ticket.
Exactly.
Golden ticket for health care, golden ticket for education. Who's against a golden ticket?
It's slick and it's fast and loose with the truth, and the people that are going to tell you the truth are your unions. They are your advocates for the poor and your advocates for the elderly and your advocates for kids that aren't getting what they need. And those are the folks that are being silenced. Our unions are very strong. I've checked the records of our NEA membership. You would be shocked to know how few billionaires we have working in America's public schools, colleges, and universities. We will absolutely never have the money that the Koch brothers have.
You just want to make a living, not a killer.
All we have to compete with their money are ourselves,
right.
People, individual voices coming together and saying, you know, if we all stick together and we all pool our money and throw some of our, you know, we'll form a union and we'll end up being able to be on the 6 o'clock news, and the governor will have to take our calls.
Because we have out-procreated the Koch brothers.
It has. We have. How about that? And what, you know, what we're seeing is they're looking and they're going, wow, you could actually win elections because you guys actually get people, you knock on doors and you get people to the polls and you tell them the truth about who stands for what. So let's just get rid of these unions. Let's silence these teachers. Let's silence these firefighters, people who work for an honest paycheck and have some honest information. We don't want the people to have that. So let's get rid of collective bargaining in Wisconsin. Let's turn Michigan into a right to work for less state. Let's go state by state, or my God, when Mitt Romney was the candidate, he was talking about a national right to work for less state where you'd make it as hard as possible to form a union.
Or as I called it during the whole time, his no rights at work agenda.
No rights. And there's a reason why that kind of campaign is so well funded, because the people like the Koch brothers, people who do not like the competition that an ordinary sixth grade teacher from Utah, like myself, can get into a leadership position, not because of how much money I got, but because I belong to a group of over 3 million passionate people who will not be silent. And that is a slap in the face to them. They're going, you're not rich, you're not powerful, you don't have a title and a corner office like we do. How dare you? And this is all an attempt to put working people in their place. I take it even a little more personal than that, because I'm an education union. 78% of educators are women.
Wow.
And I look at this as, and you're a woman, for goodness sakes. You know, what are you doing talking to the press and telling them that the governor is lying when he's lying?
Right.
You know, how dare you attack these powerful, rich people that I put in place to be able to privatize our public schools, privatize your pension? How dare you? And so I look at this as a slap on several different levels. And as you can see, I'm very shy about speaking out. Yes, I'm scared to death. They are organizing. They are helping us organize in ways they didn't mean to.
Well, they've awakened a sleeping giant.
Oh, yeah.
When we
people
were in
who
Wisconsin.
Were going, well, I've got pretty good benefits, and I don't make a lot of money, but it's regular paycheck, and I'm good. All of a sudden,
They're talking about me.
They're saying I shouldn't have the power to have an organized voice, because the only voices, I guess, that should be heard are voices that you can pay for. You know, and the Koch brothers have all the money that they could possibly want to put on commercials to do that.
No, they don't have all they could
want. You're right. Let me put that in different. It's like there's a dollar in your pocket that they don't have in their pocket.
Left.
So, I look at this, and I can go out and talk to some pretty underpaid educators.
And we do all the time.
Oh, yeah. And I can tell them, these folks would dismantle your little pension plan that gives you a tiny modicum of retirement security and have you invest it with them and their buddies on Wall Street, when we know that that whole agenda is about sucking out as many
Absolutely.
Fees and commissions
yep.
as they can. They can't do that with your pension plan. They can do that with millions of individuals who are powerless against
well,
them.
Well, in Pennsylvania, I've been saying for the longest time, what they want to do is they want to, as they've done with citizens in their government, as they've done with workers in their unions, they want to do the same thing with workers in their pensions. And that's
yeah.
that's divorce you from any possibility of professional services, any possibility of unity. So like any graft that you'll ever see, it gets the lone sheep out on its own for the slaughter. And it's just now pensions are part of it.
They do not like organized, powerful, middle class people who work for a paycheck. To them, they don't know what to do with that.
They want people who are subservient and do
exactly.
what they're told.
If you are frightened, you will be compliant. You will be nervous. You will do what you're told.
Which is
exactly.
why shy people like you have to be silent.
Exactly. And it's like, oh, my God, some guy named Rick Smith gave this lady a microphone. We got to get rid of Rick Smith. We got to get rid of Lily. Their whole agenda is to take that microphone out of your hand and out of my hand so that ordinary people can't hear our voices. We have a different point of view than you are going to get with the Fox News group
yep.
that are funded by the funders of the Republican Party. You are going to get a different kind of story. And what they have is a storyline that says, teachers all got into this because we're greedy and we don't like children. Yes, I wanted to get rich. That was why I wanted to be a sixth grade teacher in Utah. Okay.
That was not a really great business plan.
Not a good business plan. And our educators know we want to work with kids because we love kids and we see that as the most important work. This is like the Peace Corps for us.
Yeah.
And the fact that, and we know we're never going to be millionaires. That's not what motivates us. But we do want our families to be able to have some security, a regular paycheck, some decent benefits. And by the way, we want the families we serve to have those things too. We want our next door neighbors to have those things too.
Instead of saying, hey, why do you have it? You shouldn't.
And
we
that's
say,
what
we
they
should
did.
All have it.
You know, they've said, hey, unions now are seeing less and less opportunity to organize. They more and more barriers to organizing those ordinary people.
Yeah,
you know, we had the manufacturing sector and the public sector, and now we're seeing that constant drumbeat to weaken unions, taking its toll. We have to find new ways of organizing, because all of those middle-class parents in the middle-class communities that we work with, we're seeing those kids not have the health care that they need. We're seeing their parents have to work two or three jobs because you can't get a living wage job anymore. And we care about all of them. We care about the community. And that's why we wanted to work with children in a public school.
And so, I'm glad that you do. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Lily Eskelson-Garcia. She's a vice president of the NEA. National Education Association. You know, we're doing this cross-country labor history tour because I find, and this is one of those things that, you know, I take very personally because, you know, growing up, I saw labor unions as an opportunity to get into the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
My kids aren't being taught that. It's not in society. It's certainly not in schools. So I have a 4, 7, and 11-year-old that I wanted them to see the history of workers in this country. But there has been a concerted effort by the same players, the Kochs, the DeVosses, you know, the billionaire class, to not just hide labor history, but to eviscerate it.
Right.
But to completely take it off the map and to rewrite it. So as we're going across the country, I look at education as one of those things that, you know, the benevolent corporations now will give us instead of something that coal miners and truck drivers and all of the people of the past fought, bled, and died for.
Okay, so it's not ready yet, but I am in the middle of writing a children's book on biographies of social justice warriors called Rabble Rousers, and the very first one is Mother Jones. There are too many people that think Mother Jones is a magazine. That's all they know about labor history. There were people who were beat up. There were people who died organizing miners, organizing ordinary people to simply have the right to have a unified voice and collectively bargain so that you would not individually beg for your job. People should watch The Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah.
They should watch Henry Fonda and read the book. This was real, and it's becoming, unfortunately, real again. Individuals that we're the rugged individual, we're the John Waynes, we can do it all by ourselves.
Horatio Alger,
of course, you don't need anybody else. You know what? The Gandhis and the Nelson Mandelas and the Mother Joneses of the world, and by the way, the Dream Act kids that are out there coming out as undocumented and saying, all I want is the right to go to a college or a university when I graduate. I don't want to be deported for a decision I didn't make when I was brought here as a six-month-old baby. They're organizing. That's the only power that ordinary people have.
Yep.
The power to organize each other, to form those networks, to say if we stand together, they can't pick us off one at a time.
I look forward to the book.
I'm
gonna give you my card, and when you get these books out, you got to come back and you've got to talk about it.
I will do it because it's time has come. I went to too many schools doing presentations to kids, and I'd start by saying, "Who are your heroes? Rock stars, movie stars,
baseball
sports
players.
Stars, talented people, rich people," and I would mention the names of people who changed this country. And maybe they'd know,
Martin Luther King.
And then
but they don't know why he was in Memphis.
They don't.
They don't know why he was there, because to stand up for those sanitation workers, who to this day still don't have pensions.
I'm writing, and I met some of those sanitation workers
at
an AFSCME march. On the anniversary that Martin Luther King was killed, asked me always, because they represent those sanitation workers, and they always have a march, and they invited me to come and to sing Solidarity Forever. I sing fabulous, too. You'll love that. But the bottom line is I got tired of having to go class by class telling kids there were people who fought for you for things that you don't even think about.
Yep.
Your right, especially if you're a minority kid, your right to sit in that seat. Someone died for that.
Absolutely.
And
so let me ask you a last question then, because, you know, I look at our time in Wisconsin in February of 2011. Right. You had that uprising. And my view of it, it was sparked because those college kids, those graduate assistants, mm-hmm. who heard the governor say, we're going to call out the National Guard,
right.
went back to their labor education, because it's mandatory in Wisconsin to have at least some labor education. They said, wait a second, that sounds like that.
Right.
Is there a movement of trying to get labor education into schools across the country? Because I think it's important that we know where we came from. This idea that we have benevolent corporations who give us things.
Absolutely. And you know what? It's not on the standardized test, so we are having a hard time getting that voice in there. But we have very talented educators, members of the National Education Association, who have shared with us curriculum. We make it available. We put it online. But it has to be institutionalized.
Exactly.
Right. It has to be something where you can go and say to a Board of Education, in almost every school, they have some kind of mandate, or they simply do it, to have, we need you to understand the capitalist system. We need you to understand free markets. They got that like that. And when it's like, and you have to understand there's always a balance to power, or you end up with a totalitarian nightmare. There has to be, and the balance to that capitalist structure is a union.
Yep.
a union.
So when my daughter was told, you want to learn about history, watch the history channels of the people who built America, which talks about, had today's robber barons
right.
telling us how wonderful yesterday's robber barons
right,
were.
Right.
And those workers, they were just tools that yeah, they just did the work.
Those were the Koch brothers of yesteryear.
Yep.
I remember going to Newport, Rhode Island, and they actually give you like this Robert Barron's mansion tour, you know. I called it that, but you were going on this mansion tour, and people going, now this is where they came during the summer months. So you were walking through these literal palaces.
What, have you ever been to Vanderbilt's house?
Yes, the Vanderbilts, the DuPonts, the, you know, everybody, and the Carnegies, and I'm going, okay, railroads, Chinese labor. You're looking at people who made their money on mines and factories, and you're kind of you know how many people starved working for them. How many people died in unsafe workplaces working for them get this Newport mansion?
But we've got pretty buildings.
And they're just gorgeous.
And what are the dreams and hopes of workers? Yeah, we got this pretty building.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lily, it was great talking with you. I appreciate your
time. I can't wait to do my book tour.
And I can't wait for you to come back.
I will be here.
We want copies.
It has color pictures. And the illustrator is my husband.
Nice. My daughter's writing a book, and we've got a friend who's going to illustrate it as well for this tour, because we want to do a lot of the same
things. Well, and all the proceeds, we're hoping that this will be out in another month or two. All the proceeds will go to United We Dream, the Dream Act kids.
Nice.
Yeah.
Lily Eskilson Garcia, we appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Quick break, right back. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
And they're talking in the town.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Happy holidays, everyone. I'm Rick Smith, and I'd like to invite you to tune in here each and every night through the remainder of 2013 for encore performances of our People's Tour for America.
And I'm Pat LaMarche. I traveled with Rick and his family this past summer on the People's Tour, and we met some pretty amazing folks. So from now until 2014, you'll be able to hear those folks tell their story of how the middle class grew in their part of America. Join us right here weeknights from 9 till midnight.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, the People's Tour for America. If you want to follow the tour, you can do that at peoplestourforamerica.com. You can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, email us, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Lots of ways to interact with the program. You know, in wrapping up today's visit to Netroots Nation, and, you know, I look at that Raise Up America campaign saying, you know what, those jobs, the fast food workers, the retail workers, we should be making those middle-class living wage jobs, at least, Pat.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're making a coffee drink for somebody to have, that costs more than an hour's wage. There's a problem with that equation. And the whole joke that these are young people jobs, that is really funny. I mean, occasionally you'll see young people, but most of the young people you see in there are struggling to pay their student loans because, quite frankly, they're just not that young. These aren't 15- and 16-year-olds. These are 22- and 23-year-olds.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the McDonald's, the ones that I go to, you're talking people in their 50s and 60s who are behind the counter. Not the pimply-faced teenagers that we're led to believe are the ones that are working those jobs.
And even if they were, they are trying to save money so that they can get an education. And, well, you can't do that on a McDonald's wage either.
Not anymore. And you know, I know people who, in years past, were able to work a minimum wage job and be able to make ends meet, still go to college, and not end up coming out saddled with a generation of debt.
But that wasn't working into the plan. See, bankers needed to be able to get their hands on a kid's future.
Bankers. You know what's going on July 1st?
What's that?
for all those students who took out those massive loans, if Congress doesn't act,
it's going to go up.
Doubles. The interest rate doubles from 3.4 to 6.8%.
Did I hear you right? We are relying on Congress?
Yes.
Oh, my.
July 1st. And oh, another one of those things we learned here, and we've talked about in the past, but was reminded to me while at Netroots Nation. And if you missed any of our coverage of Netroots Nation or the People's Tour for America, you can go to thericksmithshow.com or peoplestourforamerica.com. We're on the road. There are lots of photos, a lot of opportunities to interact with what we're doing. If you've got any thoughts, questions, comments, whatever's on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. We appreciate the input, the thoughts. We'll be back tomorrow on the road. Stick around. Tune in. We'll be back.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can...